Good morning, honorable members and colleagues. It's 9 o'clock, and we are, from our side, ready to go. AG and his team are here, and the legal friends are here. And our colleagues from SCOPA are here. So I think all the role players are here. The agenda, honorable members, before we even welcome anybody, but the agenda is, after apologies, which we'll do in a second, is to get a final briefing from the legal team in terms of the Public Audit Act amendments. We'll allow AG and his team to comment if they want to comment on it, because I know they were working jointly. And we will allow members from SCOPA and from SCOAG to pose questions of clarity, if there are going to be any questions of clarity, because after the session we're going to go behind closed doors and as a committee finalize it. So it's our last opportunity to engage with the experts, so to say. So we will, if necessary, have to field some questions as the authors, and after that it will be a matter of the committee to go and tighten it up. So that's the first. Then, AG, I was informed that you were going to, over and above your own presentation, there was going to be a presentation by the audit committee. But Cindy was talking to me this morning via text saying that that has not come. Adil had not sent that to us. I'm not sure if we're still going to have an audit committee presentation.
Chair, they're on their way up, so they might just give a verbal feedback when they arrive.
Okay. It's not always ideal. I mean, we always want a document before we come. Otherwise, it makes it very difficult for us to interact. So there will be a presentation from the audit committee. Members, we don't know what it is because we've not received it, but you should have received from the AG his strat plan and his annual report. I think from the AG we've received everything that we need. And the audit committee we will get. Then I'm looking at our own support. Members should have for this first session the amendments that will be presented by the legal team. You should have the original Public Audit Act or the current Public Audit Act. And you should have a legislative proposal which we need to adopt so that it goes to the House of our business to start. I'm looking at members, and we should have minutes. I'm sure minutes, people, honorable members have minutes. Anybody is lacking documentation? If not, thank you very much. But if you are, please indicate there are hard copies. Honorable members, in terms of apology, well, first of all, the agenda as we've proposed and that you have, is that acceptable? The agenda, is it acceptable? Adoption of committee minutes, draft bill, audit committee, auditor general, closing. Happiness? Thank you very much. In terms of apologies, Mem Dubazana Dlamini would want to leave at 12:30, and that's fine. And then we've got apologies from Honorable Singh. I think they are celebrating Diwali. Mpanza, Carter, and Mtombela also have put in apologies. Honorable McLaughlin.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just add Mr. Topham to that list? He also put in an apology, I understand.
Okay. Are those apologies acceptable? And others will join us later. I know that Kuno and Nyami Boy and others will join us later. They're busy somewhere else. Okay, those are the apologies, honourable members. In terms of minutes, we should have a set of minutes of the 18th of November. Can we postpone those minutes because we don't have a quorum? Can we postpone them because we don't have a quorum until later and get straight into the business of the major business of the day, which is the Acts? Just as introductory remarks, honourable members, the Auditor General presented to SCOPA on Tuesday the audit outcomes. He also presented to the Committee of Chairpersons on Wednesday. And in both presentations, what has been very clear is the need for the Auditor General or the work of the Auditor General to be taken more seriously by us as the members of Parliament who are primarily responsible for oversight, and also by the Department and or the auditees of the Auditor General. And that was the genesis of this amendment, honourable members will remember, because, I mean, at the time we were saying he just does not, or the Auditor General doesn't have teeth. We are hoping that at the end of this exercise, the Auditor General will have more teeth than he has currently. So that's really, it's become, honourable member, you will agree with me, it's become urgent that we do these things. The frustration at SCOPA is unbelievable. So I'm hoping that members will ask the real questions, the hard questions. AJ and his team will help us as far as possible, and then we still plan to have this thing taken to the National Assembly before year end as a proposal in terms of the bill. By year end, we're hoping to take it, AJ, so that next year you'll have a bit more teeth if it is accepted. So that's really the rationale and the genesis of this act. Can I then ask that Ms. Fatima Ibrahim and whoever else is there to take us through, together with your assistant from League, from the AEG, we will give you guys, can we give you half an hour to take us through it and then allow members to comment if necessary? All right. Between the two of you, half an hour, and then we will comment, and the AG if he wants to, and then we will comment. Over to you, Fatima.
And good morning, Chair, honourable members, and the Auditor General and colleagues. As per our last meeting, we were mandated to go back and look at some of the problematic areas and iron out the issues and concerns that we had raised. Our legal services work closely with Ms. Marissa Besaidenhout, who is the head of legal at the AG's office. And I think that the product we've produced is something that both parties are now happy with. But I'll take you through those changes. My presentation today, I'm going to do a broad overview of the draft bill now as amended, and then also to consider the draft request for permission in terms of Rules 273 of the Rules of the National Assembly. You'll recall in the last version there were a number of terms that were problematic and that I had concerns about, the first being this idea of disallowance, or this concept of disallowance, that the AG would disallow an amount and based on that disallowance would then raise what they had termed a surcharge, and that surcharge would then be recovered from the relevant official. I found that the definition was extremely broad because it had spoke to expenditure that was contrary to law. What we've now done is that we've removed the concept altogether. So we've taken out the concept of disallowance. The reason being that in actual fact, when the AG issues their audit report, expenditure is already classified in that report. The losses are already there, whether it be irregular, fruitless and wasteful, or unauthorized. So there was no need for a second step now to have an action called disallowance. So we've taken that out. Then the other major issue I had was with the term surcharge. You will recall that I said that that implies that we are taxing an amount or it's some other sort of cost that is involved, when in actual fact the intention there was merely to recover an amount from the responsible person. So what we've done now is simply replaced the word surcharge with recover throughout the text. The other problematic definition and concept was the issue of a nominated account, in terms of which the AG, once recovering money, would be able to deposit it into a nominated account. And my question there was, how would they nominate an account and which account would that be? What would be the criteria for nominating an account? That we've also now removed, and we've simply replaced it with a national provincial revenue fund, as the case may be. So in other words, money will simply go back to source. So those are the main concepts that we removed from the first draft. I'm now going to take you through all the amendments that we've now made.
So that we don't get lost as members. Can we stop at that one and just get a sense from members? Are you happy with the changes to those three? Nominated, you recall, we said let's be more specific. What were the other two members? Just go back to that other slide of the first slide. Disallowance and surcharge. Just can we just have a discussion on that so that we pass it and move on?
Comrade, maybe for that question, I just wanted to check, is there no paper, which one?
We have a presentation on
not the presentation, the bill.
Page 8. Oh, okay, no, that's fine. I just wanted to
ask. It's very informal, so you're able to talk and sing if you want to.
Okay.
Are we happy with those three changes? No, I was just saying let's be as informal as possible because this is our last opportunity to have an interaction with them. Just on those three, are we comfortable? Honourable Dubazana and then Honourable Gordy.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, we are so sorry. For me, if I agree. I totally agree, because, I mean, you did exactly what we requested. That they were too broad, you could not understand. And if you look at how we have crafted it on page 8, it's clause 1BA, it's 1BA clause A, it's well crafted. So, Chair, I really don't have a problem with it.
Gordy, just on the concept?
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Yeah. All right, thanks, ma'am. We will stop you occasionally so that members can ask. Otherwise, I think it'll be too much information.
Okay, that's fine. What we've now done is we've inserted new definitions. I've inserted a definition of accounting authority and accounting officer, because you will recall that one of the fundamental changes that we were asked to make was that the AG would not recover money from every single official. You would recover directly from the responsible accounting officer. This speaks to that issue of a convolution of roles and role clarification that I sought in the last meeting. So the current draft now says that the AG will recover directly from the accounting officer or the accounting authority. The reason that accounting authority is added, because some institutions don't have an accounting officer. Their board serves as their accounting authority, so you would also be able to recover funds from the board. Members will be held jointly and severally liable. Then I've introduced two new concepts, the debt and the debtor. The AG, you will recall, will issue a certificate. The amount that appears on that certificate is what is now described as the debt. The accounting officer or members of the accounting authority who are named on the certificate become debtors. They are now debtors to the state because they now owe this money. The term prescribed was added. That's simply just to make things easier. Instead of referring to Section 52, which is the regulation section, we simply say as prescribed. And then also there's a definition of undesirable audit outcome. That definition speaks to the matters that the AG can refer for further investigation. Okay, now to the actual changes, past the definition section.
Sorry. We're going to go okay. Section by section so that members can have it. On definitions, any questions? Honorable Gordon.
Yeah, on the...
And Honorable Dubazana, the afternoon.
On the debtor, the accounting officer is fine because we know there's always one accounting officer. On the accounting authority, I just want a little bit of explanation on the definition there because it says individual members of the accounting authority. Is it now individual responsibility or is it collective responsibility? Because this then takes it to individual responsibility. Or so it appears that in a board you can pick one or two people and say you will be liable as opposed to you as a collective, as a body.
Okay.
Fine. You'll take all of them. All of you will take all of them, yes? On definition?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. It's almost similar. It was a matter of like clarifying the roles, whether those two definitions, they are okay, but I think, Chair, if we're taking far down, let's say to the local government, to the local government, how it then gets, you know, explained? Is there another definition other than those two? Because the authority part of it, especially executive authority, the part of it. If you look at the three spheres of government, it says sometimes different definitions. Maybe we need to take consideration of that and like what Honorable Gordy has actually said, and also I don't know, but it does give some concern.
Before you come in, Mr. McLachlan, now we'll allow you. I'm going to say to members that when you pose a question, maybe pose your proposed solution so that we can all debate it. Because it's really not about them. We must say, if we have a problem like Gordy was saying now, what about this? That's all I'm saying, just so that we move faster, Honorable Members. Otherwise, it means we must come back to the session. Honorable McLachlan, just on definitions, or just on Section 1 as we have it here, up to page 4, or the top of page 5.
Thank you, Chair. Just in general, I think I welcome the changes. I think it makes it clearer. There can be no misunderstanding as to what a debt is. And a debtor, the accounting officer at local level is always the municipal manager. So it's a person, yes, a specific person. The accounting authority, it's going to be members of the accounting authority identified in the certificate. So I imagine that the AG will know which individual members of that accounting authority he is actually saying you're the responsible person. So it will be always going to a specific person. It can't be otherwise if you're going to say this person is responsible for the repayment. That's the whole nature of this thing. It's supposed to be punitive. And it's supposed to say this person here made the mistake. That's the person who must pay back the money. That's my understanding of it. So I'm just saying I support what's here because to me there's nothing unclear or that I don't understand. Thank you, sir.
Let me add my 2 cents worth and then you can come in. I tend to want to emphasize what Honorable Gordy is saying. My understanding is that the board is a collective and all decisions are taken by virtue of board resolutions where the majority of board members yay and others nay. So when we say a debtor means individual members of the accounting authority, and I'm using, let's take SABC, the accounting authority is the board. Are we then saying individual members, or we can pinpoint somebody on the SABC board, or should we not be saying the SABC board is the responsible? And they amongst themselves can talk about whether it was the chair, whether it was the remunerations committee, but it's a resolution of the board, not of an individual. So for me, that debtor, I think we should take out individual. That's just my view. We should take out individual and make it the collective. If you can respond to all those questions that are there.
Okay, Chair. On the issue of where there is an accounting authority, the accounting authority would be the board, and the way that we envisage that it would unfold is that the board members would be held collectively responsible, so what we call jointly and severally liable in law. When you do an actual recovery, you would be free to act against one person or to act against all people. Usually, no, you would act against the strongest party when you're actually trying to recover the money. So even though the certificate, when it's issued, it would name all of the board members as a collective, but it would name them individually because each of them then become a debtor. If we go to court to recover the money, we can choose then to recover from the strongest, the person with the strongest financial position on the board. That person, though, in turn, would have a civil right to claim from the other board members. So they would have to go and do that themselves. But this would allow us to target the person with the strongest financial position or to target all collectively. But every single person on the board would be listed as a debtor. So all of them would be responsible. If they wish to make a payment arrangement where they split amounts and so on, then that will be accommodated. That's my understanding of how we see it working in practice. But Chair, I propose that perhaps what we do is, on the definition of debtor, says means the accounting officer or individual members of the accounting authority collectively identified instead of identified in the certificate. We can add the word collectively there.
Remember, honourable members, Fatima and your team, remember we had given you the layman's understanding of what we wanted. We wanted you guys to go and put it into legalese so that it stands the test of time. And that's all that we're going to be saying. If members feel that you still haven't done it, we're going to say that, but we're really expecting you to make sure that this thing is not contestable.
Sure.
At court, Honourable Gordon.
Yeah. Coming on that, she said this is how we envisage it to work. I'll be more comfortable if she says this is how practice is, because then if bringing in a procedure that is not legally tested and there's no precedent, then that's where you're going to have those issues around challenge. So the explanation that she has given, is it a logical explanation or is it a legal explanation?
All right. I think what we're going to do, because we're not going to ratify this thing today, I think we're doing that on the 18th, looking at the team, the next meeting. 17th. Yeah, on the 17th we'll ratify it. So between now and the 17th, if you can come and give us something, so that when we sit behind closed doors, we will, amongst each other, agree whether we're comfortable with the approach or the wording that you have, or we will change it. But this is one where we're saying to you, we're just not very comfortable on that one. Is that all right, honourable members? We will, as soon as they've given us a response, we'll give it to members so that we can finalise it on the 17th. All right? Can we move on to section 2?
Okay. That's on page 5 of the version in front of you. We've inserted a new subsection 3, capital A, to allow the AG to prescribe criteria in relation to conducting discretionary audits. Now, Section 3 of the Principal Act already empowered the AG to conduct these discretionary audits on request of public entities or entities funded by the state. The problem practically that they faced was that they were being inundated with requests to perform these audits. And often these requests would come from very small auditees where the turnover, the cost of the audit at least, would be higher than what the turnover of that institution was. So say, for example, if you took a small library or a museum, it doesn't justify spending that sort of resources to do an audit on such a small institution. So what the AG is now proposing is that the AG be allowed to prescribe criteria for conducting such audits, and those criteria would be part of regulations, where they would, for example, now cap amounts and size of the institution and have some basis on which they can filter out those smaller ones that it doesn't make practical sense to do. The next one, also still on page 5, is the amendment of subsection 4 to extend this discretion irrespective of conflicting legislation. So it may be that you have a principal piece of legislation that says the AG must conduct an audit on that institution. For example, if I again use a museum, the AG must conduct an audit on that museum. This change to the Act now would mean that notwithstanding that another piece of legislation compels the AG to do that, they would then still be able to exercise their discretion using the criteria as prescribed.
Comments? Happiness. It's very clear. I mean, that's what we debated and argued the whole time last time. And I think you also must make a, if you feel that they're not representing you, AG, when I say you, I'm saying all of you, because it's your last opportunity. After this, we will go behind closed doors and deal with it as we understand it. So all of you have an opportunity to assist us. AG, quickly.
Thank you, Chair. No, I thought perhaps to reinforce the point that Fatima made regarding the background to this 3A. This is one of the issues that we've always confronted when we go out to communicate our audit outcomes, where attention is taken away from the real issues and we start debating about how costly the audit is. So this is really a power to give us the discretion to look at, for example, an entity that is required to be audited according to the law, but when we look at it, it has not even operated for the last 2 years, and the reality is that there's been no appropriation for it going into the future. So it's that kind of allowance so that we don't go there and do the normal audit procedures that would have been applicable to a different environment, as long as we make sure on our side we do the proper assessment of risks associated with that. So the opinion will probably be a limited review type opinion in that year. Thanks.
Happiness. Thank you very much. Move on, Fatima.
Okay. The next one is inserting a new subsection 5.1a capital A, and this empowers the AG to conduct performance audits and issue findings in respect thereof. A performance audit would be where auditee requests the AG to perform an audit outside of the normal audit cycle. The fundamental thing here is that despite the fact now that it's a request that's coming from the auditee, the AG can actually issue findings, so adverse findings, and then even make a referral on those findings. I understand that the practical difficulty was that auditees sometimes were of the view that the AG could not issue findings on these discretionary performance audits, as it were. So they were happy for the AG to come in but not actually issue findings.
Good morning. Thank you. I just would like to clarify a little bit further. The challenge that we had on the performance audit mandate in the Public Audit Act as it stands is that there is a reference to the 3Es, the auditing of efficiency, economic, and effectiveness, as part of your reporting paragraph. So where we got challenged in the past, with an auditee would, for example, say, but Auditor General, you cannot do a standalone performance audit. You can do it only as part of a normal financial or regularity audit. So the intention behind this amendment was purely to crystallize this mandate to conduct standalone performance audits. It's now very clear, and it reads very much similar to what the old Auditor General Act of 1995 was.
Happiness? Thank you very much. Continue, ma'am. Put your mic.
The next one is the insertion of a new subsection 5.1a capital B, which now empowers the AG to conduct international audits. We're on page 7. The page numbers are in the first column of the presentation, just to assist you. So they will now be able to conduct international audits, but there's certain criteria that would be applicable, the most important there being that they would require the prior approval of this committee. And then secondly, that the services may not compromise the efficiency of the AG or put an undue strain on the AG. So once those conditions are met, the AG can then proceed. I think it's quite important that they be empowered to conduct these audits because it definitely would assist in elevating the status and international reputation of our AG's office.
No, I'm happy, except that for me, it was just only one issue that was missing, that the time frames, if you were to come and audit me and I'm in Australia and they are to come to us, isn't that at least we must put some duration of time that has to happen within this before I run away from the Australia. That was just missing for me.
Any other
Chair, just on this mandate, if you trace it back where it comes from, it's already been there in the Public Audit Act, but a flag was raised after the Carter Asmal report was released in 2007 to call for clarity on the international mandate. I think that's where it came from. But if you look at the assignments that we have often done, a lot of them would be the African Union, SADC, any agencies of the United Nations, for example, UNESCO or any one of those, including the United Nations itself, which we were auditors to for some 12 years up to 2012. So that's the kind of audit mandate that we've always had. But now here it provides us the clarity that was sought through that Carter Asmal report in terms of those recommendations. Thanks.
Clear. Thank you very much. We're going to push you for time.
Okay, the next one, it's inserting a new subsection 5.1 capital A, and this empowers the AG to now make a referral on any undesirable audit outcomes to an appropriate body for investigation. So if whilst doing their audit, there is an undesirable audit outcome, they can refer it to, by way of example, the Public Protector or the Hawks or whichever other body is relevant in relation to whatever that finding is.
Cody?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And I think for me this is the crux that brings about the substantive difference that we seek to make. And I quite remember the last time I was here. I don't want to say the last time we're here because I'm not sure if there was any subsequent meeting thereafter. Yes, it was explicitly the Hawks and the Public Protector. I'm not sure, Comrade Chair, if because then it impacts on other pieces of legislation, but I do think this is the one area where we need to firm it up. Of the institutions that we have that might actually assist, I think the one that is most appropriate than all of them, I think, is the SIU. Because the SIU, if you look at how they work, they investigate these instances of maladministration and all the wrong things that are there. And they are able to bring out information for purpose of disciplinary action within departments and serve as witnesses. They are able to identify, isolate criminal incidences, and in terms of the law, directly refer that to the NPA for action. I think if there is a body that is perfectly positioned to deal with these matters, because anyway, all the proclamations that the President does for the SIU to investigate would in most cases be issues that the Auditor General has reported on. So instead of the Auditor General saying, I've made these findings, I want them investigated, he has reported, and then at some point the President will then decide, I want you to investigate this. So I think if we had the SIU as the primary organ that would deal with this, I think it would be much, much more appropriate than the Public Protector or the Hawks. And I'm very alive to what it means, because the SIU exists, there is an act which determines how they function, how they do their work, what will be the implication if we so say here in relation to their mandate and the procedures that are there. But I think it is the most appropriate institution that could be utilized.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a slight problem with what Honourable Cordy is suggesting. On the basis that the SIU can only do an investigation on the instruction of the President. So it means it takes the AG's authority out of the picture, because the AG can recommend it and the President can say, no, I'm not going to do it. End of story. And I think that that's defeating the object of the exercise. So I'd be very reluctant to follow that path.
Okay, the same here, Chair, that there is too many things that are involved within the SIU investigation and the signatures that are required. And also the SIU has things that they do not get involved in, like arresting a person and in terms of their mandates, there are things that fall outside of it. So the term that is utilized here to say relevant body, I think it's much more relevant. It's a term that we must just leave it there. So we will just sort. Auditor General will have an open field to approach either SAPS, SIU, HOGS, whoever. So if it's relevant body, it's much easier.
All right.
Chair.
No. Yeah, before I come to you, it's fine. Let's come to you because this will be a political discussion amongst ourselves eventually, isn't it? But
yeah,
go ahead.
Just 2 points. See, if the Auditor General reports that there is 14 billion rands of irregular expenditure at PRASA, that is not necessarily a criminal case, objectively. You must investigate and determine whether was there administrative negligence or criminal action. And I'm saying that is the area of speciality of the SIU, the first instance. Two, the point that is making, I said my suggestion obviously will impact on existing legislation. I'm aware of that. What I'm saying is that it might imply that we may then need to say, how do we amend the SIU Act to ensure that the Auditor General does not have to rely on the President, but it becomes automatic or has the powers to say to the SIU, look, I want you to investigate 1, 2, 3, 4, and they act and don't have to wait for the President. I took cognizance of that reality, that as things stand, the SIU must make an application to Justice must process it and then send it to the President. It will take 3, 4, 5, 6 months before there is any action. So I'm aware of that. My proposal implies that we must have the understanding that we must actually now look at the SIU Act and say, how is it impacted upon, so that it is an instrument that can be properly and fully utilized.
The only problem I have pressed... No, I'm saying the only problem with Honorable Godi's proposal is that it doesn't allow for dynamism within the law. It says stick with this institution and don't change. And if that institution faces changes, then this has to impact on others. You see. But if ever you say relevant body, it allows the law or any other act that has taken place to be able to impact on different other institutions. But if you direct it in this way, we are then making it very difficult, because issues that are related to corruption are not just one focus. They can happen in different ways. Now, if you put it in that way he wants, you then have to force everything to be given to the SIU, and then the SIU reject, and what happens after that? Then it becomes another problem that we have to relook at the law and relook at other institutions that could be able to assist the Auditor General. But if you leave it in this way, it's easy for the Auditor General and all other institutions to engage each other and come to a decision that where do we direct this particular one to. So for me, that relevant board, I agree with Honorable Mente that it's more important, it's more acceptable, it doesn't make it difficult and committal for the Auditor General to stick only with one institution when it wants the work to be done.
I don't want to speak for Godi, but I don't have a dialogue. I thought Honorable Godi was saying the appropriate body, with the SIU being the primary one or something like that. So he was not removing the others. He was saying the SIU must be the primary one. Without saying the others mustn't work. You'll recall the last time we said the public protector and the hawks, and then we felt, look, why are we elevating one or two? So It's fine. I don't know if you want to comment on it, but you don't have to comment on it. It's really our business here, because I don't think we are differing. There's just emphasis that is being put on by Honorable Comrade Gordy. The rest, as it stands here, includes everybody, including the SIU. So we'll have that discussion, and we'll come back to you. But we will have that discussion. Members will have to go and think about it if we want to strengthen it to become more specific in Clause 1A, capital. Continue.
The next one is inserting the new subsection 5.1 capital B to recover losses from AOs or accounting authorities. This is now the heart of the changes, the heart of the bill. And what it does is this section in its entirety now provides for the procedure for recovery. As I explained earlier, we're now going to recover losses from AOs or accounting authorities and not officials as per the previous version. Losses are defined as any irregular, unauthorized, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure or any loss suffered by the auditee due to failure to collect monies due to the state or recover monies improperly paid. The AO accounting authority is provided an opportunity to explain their failure to recover, and only in the absence of a satisfactory explanation will the AG then issue a certificate for recovery. The certificate names the debtor and states the debt, and it serves as prima facie proof of the debt. The debtor must pay within 180 days, failing which the AG may institute civil recovery processes in court. Alternatively, the debtor may make payment arrangements to extend the payment deadline and also to permit the AG to claim from their employer or other organ of state that owes the debtor money. So, for example, if the debtor needs to receive a payment from SARS or a pension payment from the government pension fund, they can agree that the claim is made against that institution. The monies collected must be deposited into the national or provincial revenue fund, depending on the source, and the AG then may not withdraw that certificate once issued, except with a prior approval of the NA. Chair, if you will indulge me, I've done a little, if we can switch the lights off, because I think it's not very clear on the screen. But I've tried to do, there's a reason I'm a lawyer and not a creative person, but I tried my best just to do a little pictorial so that you can understand exactly how the process will unfold. I can continue. So this is the tale of Nancy, the naughty accounting officer, and I hope that we don't have a Nancy in the room. If we do, I apologize in advance. So I'm going to use the 2016-2017 financial year as a starting point. The AG will conduct its statutory audit in that year, and it then issues an audit report, which is going to classify losses. So that report will say there was irregular expenditure of this amount, fruitless and wasteful, unauthorized, and whatever the case may be. Nancy is the accounting officer. She receives a copy of the audit report, and in terms of the PFMA, she's then duty-bound to start the process now to recover those losses from the responsible officials. You'll recall the PFMA says that Nancy must now take action, I think it is, within 30 days. So Nancy must now go off and do her business. The AG steps out. Step 3, the following year when the AG does its next audit process, so for 2017-2018, they will do a follow-up with Nancy as to the progress on the recovery for that previous financial year. So that serves as a reminder to her that she should be taking active steps to recover, investigate whatever it is that she needed to do internally. At the end of the 2018-19 audit process, if Nancy has now failed to recover, so she's had all this time from the time that the initial report was issued, the AG will then issue a request for a satisfactory response. And the format in which that will be done will be prescribed in a regulation. So she's going to be asked the question to give an explanation. The AG will receive the explanation and must now consider, and will now have an election once the response is considered, whether the process ends there or whether there's a need to continue. Now, it may be that the accounting officer, Nancy, hasn't actually managed to recover any funds, but that's not because she hasn't taken steps. So she has perhaps taken civil action against officials. Perhaps the officials have resigned, they're bankrupt, whatever the case may be, but she's tried her best. That may warrant an end of the process there. If not, the AG then has the election to issue the certificate if he's not satisfied with her response. The certificate gets issued in the format as prescribed, so it will name the debtor, now being Nancy. It will describe the debt. It will be signed by the AG, we presume, and so on. Nancy then has three options. The first is that she can agree to pay. So she can either pay the money in 180 days. If she's not able to pay in 180 days, she can reach a payment arrangement with the AG. And then in terms of how the payment is going to be made, she can agree that the money is claimed from her employer if she works in the state, so part of her salary subject to now any labor laws, or from another organ of state if she's owed money, example, SARS or the pension fund. And even if she no longer works for the department, because remember, we will still act against people even if they've left the employ of the department. That's not going to solve the problem for them. The debt won't go away. They can agree that the monies will be deducted from their salaries with their private employers, and then the AG will make a claim against that private employer. If Nancy is unhappy about the decision, so she disagrees with the decision of the AG, she doesn't feel it's a reasonable and rational decision, she then can challenge that decision in terms of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. She also has a 180-day period in which to do that. The third thing is that Nancy can simply ignore the certificate. So she's issued with a certificate and she chooses to do nothing. The AG would need to wait for that 180 days to expire, because at that point the AG won't know whether her intention is to take the decision on review or not. But come on day 181 and she hasn't now taken the decision on review, hasn't made payment arrangements or paid, the AG can immediately then institute civil proceedings in the High Court to claim the monies. We foresee that this is going to be fairly simple, because the certificate serves as prima facie proof of the debt. Apologies. Once the AG receives the money, I think the AG is going to want to get rid of the money very quickly and pay it into the National or Provincial Revenue Fund, as the case may be. The period and the method of payment, the manner in which that payment is going to be made, is going to be prescribed in the regulations. But this little practical example just serves to show you how it will unfold in reality.
Thank you very much. I think that was the spirit, but I'll allow members to pose maybe practical questions. I've got one. Before I get there, if you went to your very first One Capital BA, you say the AG must recover from an accounting officer or accounting authority that amount. Shouldn't we say from the accounting officer? Because remember, as far as I'm concerned, whether the individual has resigned, there's always an accounting officer in that department, whether the individual is there or not. So I'm just saying, for me it's clearer that we say the accounting officer. Because if you say a accounting officer, maybe it might have been this one, he or she has left, and then we say, well, go to that one. For me, it is whoever the incumbent is. That's the first question. The second one that I want to raise, from a practical point of view, what happens if the accounting officer, AG, comes to you and says to you, yes, I agree, it was irregular, it was fruitless, it was wasteful, or whatever the case might be, but here's the letter from the minister who said I must do it. Power relations are such that the minister will force the AG, not the AG, the accounting officer to do it. Because you're saying they must recover from the accounting officer. Does that then close the door for the account, or are you saying that the accounting officer will then have the right to say, yes, I'll pay you, but I'm going to claim it from the minister? I'm just trying to understand that, because part of the problem, and I think we must be practical about this thing, part of the problem is that the minister sometimes would have been implicated in what is happening. How do we overcome that one? I know it's not your problem, it should be our problem as COPA and whoever the case might be. I'm just saying, whatever we do here mustn't take away that power that we are seeking to move towards as COPA. I know as COPA we're beginning to say, look, it can't be just the accounting officer. It should be the political authority as well. My question here is, if we, as explicit as we are, saying the accounting officer, do we not negate what Gordy and them want to do when they talk about the executive authority at some other point? That's just my 2 cents worth for this. But I think the spirit is correct, that there must be consequences. Any other comments from members before we ask you? You'll come to that. And if there are, Comrade Nyame, and then Comrade Gordy.
Unless it is said somewhere else, Chair. But in terms of the constitutionality and in a constitutional state, this type of power will have a challenge, because people do have rights, even if they have wronged. And there will always be a question that what processes did you follow, or what opportunity did you give to that particular individual to be able to dispute or agree that she has failed on this particular time. For me, it doesn't sound. I don't know if I've missed it, but I'm just saying that the constitutionality, because every person has got a right in terms of the constitution. It is, that can't just be easy, straightforward, that they are wrong, and then the AG must recover its money. But if there's a dispute, how to resolve that particular dispute?
Yeah, I think I get your point, but I suppose we have said that once the AG issues a certificate and says you, that person has a right to make a representation, isn't it? And I think it is at that point that the person will say, I was under duress, I have attached a letter from the minister, or I have a WhatsApp where I was instructed to do ABCD, and then it will be for the AG to consider that. And that might inform follow-up and subsequent action, or even court action when it arises as proof that... Now, that is the one part. The second part is in relation to the fact that she said, and I think that's also our position, somebody was in charge and they have left. And 5 weeks down the line, the AG issues a certificate about this was wrong. I've only been in as an accounting officer for 5 weeks, and the person who was there has just left. And I think that's the point. So I'm not sure whether a recovery from an accounting officer or accounting authority appropriately takes care, or it will arise in the context of those representations, that the new person will say, you know what, I only have 3 weeks here. I'm trying to familiarize myself. This thing happened at the beginning of the past financial year, and for 11 months of that financial year, this is the person who was responsible, who obviously had sufficient time to could have made follow-ups. I hope the AG can clarify that if my understanding is correct about the unfolding processes from discovery to claim. Thank you.
Honorable Dubazan, and then Honorable McLaughlin, and then you will respond and help us understand.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, Chairperson, what you are saying in reality, it does happen. But however, I find it proper that page 8, where you are referring, if you look right down after 1BA clause 1, Roman figure 2, the last, which says that within the prescribed period by the accounting officer or accounting authority, for me, for Fatima to put it that way, for me, I find it proper, Chairperson, because you know what, it's gonna teach a lesson to those accounting authorities who come and become like window dressing and carry out orders and forget about the procedures and forget about the laws and just please other people to keep their job. So if you have done that, but this is what the law is saying, that the and you have failed to submit, how come I've carried your directive because you are my minister, irrespective of what the law is saying? I find it that clause, for me, it is very valid, that I don't care whether you are instructed by whoever on top of you to do whatever, but this is what the law is saying. What did you do?
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I'd support your proposal to change AND to THE in 1BA. It must be THE accounting officer. But I think there perhaps we could either add the responsible accounting officer or accounting authority to make it more specific, that it's that officer or that accounting authority that was actually relevant to the issue and not some subsequent body or person who's taken over from a previous body where the problem arose. Or even to add all other responsible person, which then could maybe include the minister if you want to go that far. But I think we covered that before, perhaps. But I think as well, the way it's been explained to us, whoever the responsible person is going to have a year before anything happens from the one audit to the next audit. And it's only after that the 180-day period starts to arise. So you've got 18 months, in effect, to sort out all these problems. And if you've been instructed by the minister or whoever else, that's going to be part of your explanation that you're going to give to the AG and say, look, this wasn't my doing. I was forced because of this, that, and the other. So it's not... You know, by the time it gets to 18 months later, that should all have been covered. So I think we're fairly covered here. In fact, the time period is probably too long anyway. But I understand that we have to give people the chance to answer these things and to sort it out. So I don't think your concern is going to really come into effect, because constitutionally, people have the right to dispute it, to say, but I've got an explanation. And even if it didn't land up in court, you've still got the right to defend an action in court, and you can bring your... whatever defense you have there as well. So I don't think we're on rocky ground there. I'm happy with it that way, but I think we should make it more, just clearer that we after the person who is responsible, not anybody else who happens to be in that position. Thank you, sir.
I know you wanted to say something, AG, on this matter. We're not disputing the spirit. We're happy with the spirit. We just don't want it to be challenged.
Thank you, Chair. There was one part in Fatima's illustration that I wanted to add to the equation, and that is the part that is about the referral, because it's not directly from the audit report that you will claim someone has got something to pay. It's after you have concluded the audit. Then once you've concluded the audit, let's say you've considered that there's a breach contract on which, for argument's sake, 50 million has been spent, but during the audit you could not get to the bottom of what exactly is this transaction about, which then triggers either an irregular expenditure and stuff like that. So that conclusion is already in the financial statements and in the audit report. It is after we have issued those audit reports in the office that we institute an internal mechanism to sift through the issues that are amenable for handing over and as part of the referral, or those that are technical errors that do not necessarily require to be investigated. It's when that investigation report of the relevant appropriate body has been received by us, which will tell us, according to the outcome of their investigation, is this transaction an issue, and who are those people that are behind it, that we will be able to determine the factual accuracy of that. Because at a level of the audit, when you make a finding, you are only making a finding based on non-compliance with certain expected patterns of behavior. The reasoning or the issues behind that outcome is what the investigation will be pointing out. And I think that's where the strength of this thing will lie. How effective has the process of investigating that particular item be, such that when it comes to us and it says, of that 50, we found that the bulk of it is fine, but there's a worrying transaction of, let's say, 5 million rands. which indicates that there was abuse of this, and therefore we have sufficient evidence to suggest that A. Brown, or whoever the person is the person that ought to make good the loss that has been incurred after the investigation report has been received. And I think that's where the clarity in terms of who must pay and who is liable will come from that report. And that report, obviously, as we said in the bill, Chair, is the one that will be under our control in terms of the resource to fund the investigation as well as to act on the recommendations coming back from that investigation report. But the issue that was raised earlier on regarding the accounting officer, I think at our very first engagement, this same question was raised, where it was asked, are we now just focused only on the accounting officer or broader than that? Maybe we still have an opportunity to tighten that part. Thank you.
All right. For our own Cody, Honorable Cody.
Comrade Chair, I beg for your indulgence, because I think there are some parts of the process that we miss. I'm just hoping that our focus, if you look at what triggers the investigation, is undesirable audit outcome. And I think that's a generic term. And I hope in the course of the amendments we don't lose that and focus on narrowly financial losses that must be recovered. Because undesirable audit outcomes may not necessarily be because ultimately there is financial loss. It might as well be so that one did not follow procedures and the end product being an award of a tender to somebody and thus creating irregular expenditure. If we focus narrowly on financial losses and yet our starting point is undesirable audits, I think we might be coming a bit narrow and not be broader. I'm just wondering aloud, and I'm still struggling in my own head how and where that should find expression, so that this thing must not just be about financial recovery, because a greater deal of your irregular expenditure may not necessarily lead to very clearly defined financial loss.
Comrade Nyam.
Thank you, Chair. Just to narrate the point, in SASA, they talk about traffic fines, and the traffic fines, yes, they have created that there should be this irregular, but it will be difficult to know. And what the Auditor General bring to SCOPA is to say, this is what the traffic fines, and they have happened over a period, and this is what is the outcome. Now there you sit with the problem immediately that who is then taking that responsibility, and how does that process work to pin down whoever have done that particular thing. It becomes, that's the type of a situation I'm saying can arise over some time. And if you write it up in this particular way, it then makes it very difficult, even if the Auditor General says that we go there. Somebody must be able to explain in the department who handles these traffic fines and what happened to those traffic fines, which has come to a situation to a culmination of such a huge amount. Those are other different processes. And this is what I'm trying to work out, that the cases might not be the same and very simple as they have been presented.
Let us debate that inside. I think that's our own internal debate. Because I think what we are saying in terms of the Act, Honorable Nyami, and I don't want to have this with me and you, we have to identify the responsible person, being the DG. Now, even if it is the taxi driver or whoever who committed the offense that led to that, surely that shouldn't be our responsibility. And it should be the DG that says it was done by A, B, and C and have claimed it from A. I think that is what the spirit was. But the point that Honorable Gordy makes is, for me, the more fundamental one. There might not be a financial loss, but a tender that's supposed to have gone to A has come to B. And B has delivered. B has delivered what needs to be delivered, but it was denied from A because B probably somewhere else is something else. Does this cover that? I think that's what Honorable Comrade Gordy is saying. Does it cover that? Or are we just saying only where there are financial losses?
Okay. Now, Chair, it's covered. That was the reason that we didn't... So in 1, capital B, small a, it says the AG must recover, now we're going to say from the accounting officer or accounting authority, any unauthorized, irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure as defined in any applicable legislation relevant to the auditee and any other losses. So irregular then may not lead to a financial loss, but that doesn't take away from the fact that that expenditure was still irregular.
We agree with you. You see, when you say recover, as non-English-speaking people like Gordy is and I am, recover means you must get something back. In this case, we're not talking about recover. In this case, we're saying charge somebody because he's broken the law. Do you hear what we're saying? It's different from recover. Because if you say recover, I'm not sure if you're following us, and help us if we are on the wrong track, say that to us. One is to recover. But secondly, what happens, AG, if you find that a tender was given to Vincent and not given to Dubazan? Vincent delivered, but Vincent was awarded that tender because he happens to be your brother. And it didn't go to Dubazan because Dubazan, whatever. Does the Auditor General have a role to play, or are you saying you're not even going to pick that up? Because I would have assumed that in your audit, you should be able to pick up that it was not given to the lowest bidder. I'm using that as an example. And there's no recovery in terms of rands and cents, but there should be consequences because you didn't follow supply chain management. Does this act cover it? And if it does, where does it cover it?
Chair, let's just quickly recast the background to this. What we said here was that we are trying to address the issue of lack of consequences. And we were saying also that consequences is not just about getting the money back. It's also about identifying somebody who sits in a CFO position who from year to year fails the audit for various reasons, as a result of which there are growing levels of irregular expenditure and those type of things. If the outcome of that investigation confirms the fact that this person has been sitting in this CFO position for the last 5 years, as an example, there could be a recommendation that has got nothing to do with recovering money coming out of that investigation. There could well be an issue also which is about repeated qualifications in a particular auditee, where they are not able to put this solution that is required in order to get out of the qualification. They require a budget, for argument's sake. Let's take an example with the accounting for heritage assets, and you take the arts and culture cluster in government. Many of them continue to be qualified, and if one of the criteria for them to be referred for investigation was the fact that they were getting repeat qualifications, the investigation, if it is conducted in that context, would come up with issues like these people can't get out of this qualification until they get an appropriation to build the capacity that is needed in order to address your audit finding. Now, that doesn't lend itself to going to recover money from somebody, but it addresses the fact that when you leave these things over time, they become the corrosive effect that leads to financial losses ultimately. So it is a double-pronged approach. It's one that says we know that you paid 24 million rands via an EFT to that particular supplier, but when we went to the site, it's only still the foundation even after 3 years. The outcome of that investigation might lend itself for somebody who is responsible for making that 24 million payment when there's only just the foundation to explain in an investigation what exactly was this payment about that has only resulted in a foundation. That triggers a different outcome, which is about recovering the money, whereas in the same context, other audits could point to the fact that nobody cares to do anything about these audit outcomes, which might want to follow a different route. It may follow a route that says, National Treasury, some people are continuing to break the accounting framework. Are there any steps that you as accounting custodian of the financial resources are taking in order to address that particular matter if it's an institutional breakdown. So even though in the Act it doesn't say that, but in terms of the process to go through this, it will trigger different outcomes, even if it is irregular expenditure. Some of it could be that we were locked into this contract by decisions that were taken 10 years ago, as an example, but all expenditures and cash flows associated with that contract continue to trigger irregular expenditure even in the future, because it was based originally on a contract that was found to be irregular, was never investigated, and never condoned. Hence, the cash flows subsequently are all tainted with this irregular thing. Now, the question there is this something that needs to be chased through to one individual, or is it something that needs to be addressed broadly? So the outcome of that investigation through a referral will point out as to what are the recommended steps to be taken, some of which could be financial recovery and some of which could be taking very decisive steps to address something institutionally at the design level, among others. Thanks, Chair.
All right. I think we are comfortable with the financial recovery part of it, because I think that's what we're saying. This other part, I think we'll have to apply our mind to it, because my first question, AG, would be, what has stopped you from doing that up to now? What has stopped you from referring the serial offenders, as we used to call them in Scope? What has stopped you from doing that now? Are you saying, the question I'm asking is, did we need this act to do what you're saying in terms of Part B? But yes, in terms of the financial recovery, we're strengthening it. If you're saying that your referral part two would be on those matters, the obvious question is, why haven't you done it in the past? Not that we are blaming you. I'm just saying, do we need to put a line here that says that will be the second part of it? Because I don't see it in this act. In this act, I think the issue that was raised by Honorable Comrade Gordy initially was that this thing is just narrow financial. That's where it started. It was narrow financial, and we think that it should be broader than just financial. You are saying what we want to hear. The question is, should we be putting it in here, or is it in the original act? And if it is in the original act, why didn't you do it all along? If it's something that you think should be done now, the question, Fatima, is, should we just put a one-liner in here, or is it sufficient? Because I hear what the AG is saying. We will do it. The question is, what is going to empower him to do it? You can't just do it as the Auditor General. You must be empowered by a piece of legislation. Otherwise, it'll go to what Nyami Boy is saying. It might be challenged. That's all that we're asking. So if you guys could assist us in that regard. But we're happy with what you're saying. The question is, do we need to enforce it by some piece of legislation? And if we do, let's put it in this act whilst we're changing it. We want Honorable Comrade Gordy, and then we'll move on. Yeah?
Yeah. You see, Comrade Chair, I think the point that I'm trying to emphasize is that our problems are twofold. One, as you know, in the past cycle, we're dealing with irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. Regulations, firstly, the PFMA say accounting officers must prevent irregular expenditure from happening. Now, the regulations say once irregular expenditure is identified, within 30 days, investigate to confirm classification, and then investigate and take action. Now, what we don't have is that you have irregular expenditure that is not investigated in the first instance. So you sit with a regular expenditure of 3, 4, 5 years. Two, when it is investigated, no action is taken. So the issue of consequences. So now, what we're saying here, we're saying the Auditor General, if there is undesirable audit outcome, may refer it for investigation. And that's what I was talking about the SIU. So your investigation might either say, no, these people was just a dereliction of duty or responsibility, which does not lead to financial recovery. What does that mean? You have officials who did not follow regulations and the law. They must be disciplined departmentally. And I'm just saying that if we're quiet on that part, it will only be the financial recovery that is going to be acted upon. And the other part of internal disciplinary measures not being acted upon. And I would say my sense is that a majority, a lot of your irregular expenditure
is done so nicely that it falls within that category where you need to take internal action against officials so that it does not end up at that extreme end of criminality and the need for financial recovery. I think for me, I'm saying we're starting at undesirable, and undesirable has financial losses, but also it has this other aspect. And I'm just saying that somehow, somewhere along the line, let's find a way of ensuring that we give them equal weight, because applying consequences must be at those two streams, the criminal part and also the departmental action internal. Thank you. I hope I'm not complicating things.
Honorable Tubuza.
No, Chair, mine is just a proposal to the team on page 7, 1A, under B. If you can just capture what has been said, I'm not a legal person, what has been said by the Chair, because it is proper, but it will be captured properly on that clause 1A. Can you see, Fatima? Yeah. Undesirable, and then you order on, you go on with just on the legal. I think it would then become, it will cover us.
All right. As we said, we're going to have a second, well, not we, certainly along by ourselves, we're going to have a second bite and finalize it on the 17th. If you guys, we don't need you to answer all these questions now, but if you guys can assist us to give us some guidance in that regard, because I think the sentiment that is being raised now is what happens to non-financial misdemeanors? Because we hear you talking about financial ones, and we're happy with it. Just assist us with the non-financial. Does it belong in the PAA? If it doesn't belong in the PAA and it belongs to Gordy's recommendations, say that to us so that we can do it. But I'm saying we're working as a team. We're just concerned that it can't just end by financial. Where there's non-financial, we need you to assist us with your wisdom. How should we deal with it? All right, is that fair enough? And we will, when we look at it on the 17th, find a way of tidying it up. And I'm looking at you also, Goli, as the researcher. How do we deal with non-financial ones? If it's supposed to be an internal matter, for instance, I know the AG can't get involved in internal matters. We can't get involved in internal matters if we talk about separation of powers. But I think a message must be sent that there must be consequences. I think that's the message that we want to send. There has to be consequences. Continue, ma'am.
Are we comfortable with
that approach, Honourable Member? Yeah. All right.
The next one is inserting a new subsection 5, small b, capital A, which provides for the establishment of an internal remuneration committee. This committee already exists in the office of the AG, but we're just giving it a statutory, at least having a statutory provision empowering that committee. So this section sets out the composition of the committee, the requirements of membership, and the appointment of the chairperson of that remuneration committee.
It was there, you're just giving it power.
No, it was there in practice.
Yeah.
But now we're putting it into the act.
Okay. I think that is non-controversial. That's how it should be. All right. Thank you very much, ma'am. Next.
The next one is a new subsection 7.1 capital A, compelling the Independent Commission to consider the recommendations of the Remuneration Committee. So one of the functions of that committee would be to make recommendation on the salary and benefits of the AG to the Independent Commission. That commission is the commission that looks at salary and benefits of Chapter 9 heads. So they would just table their recommendations to that committee.
What's happening currently, AG? How? Where does it go to right now?
It's currently there with that independent commission, but there's no requirement that commission must consider any recommendations from any other body. Now we're saying that the commission must consider the recommendations from the remuneration committee, which will consist of people that are experienced in this area, then to do some sort of benchmarking exercise, etc., and give their report. But it's just a consideration of those recommendations. They don't need to accept.
Happiness? Thank you. Happiness, yeah. All right, continue.
Then there's inserting a new subsection 10(1) small c capital A and small c capital B, which now provides that the AG must also report on performance audits, international audits, and matters referred for investigation, as well as these debt certificates that will be issued. The Act already provides that the AG must report annually to Parliament, and it lists the issues that must be reported on. So all we've done here is to broaden the reporting requirements to cover all these additional responsibilities that have now been built into the Act. So, for example, if they now issue a certificate, they're going to have to report on the issuing of that certificate. If they do an international audit, they would need to report on those. So those are the additional powers and functions of the AG now also need to be covered in that report.
Okay. The obvious question that I'm asking, Fatima, it's fine that you, the AG will report that in his annual report that comes to us.
Yes.
The major consumers of the Auditor General's work is Comrade Gordy and his team. When are they going to know, or how is they going to know? Remember what you said. You said they will be identified in year one. AG will go back in year two and ask the accounting officer, what have you done about it, and issue a certificate. At that point, the AG will come to SCOAG and say to SCOAG, I've done something. How does Gordy and his team know what is happening there? I'm just asking that question. Unless you're saying it is then up to SCOAG to share it with Gordy and them. If you say that to us, that's fine. But I do imagine that Gordy and his team would want to know how many people have been certificated and what is happening with the certification. If it just comes to us, it leaves out a major role player. Honorable AG.
Honorable AG. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think that one is covered as part of our normal reporting processes. All that it will mean is that we now will be aware that as part of the annual briefings to SCOPA, the update on matters referred, clearance of items raised, and certificates and stuff like that will be part of the package of the direct reporting of financial statements and audit reports.
All right. Then we're all on the same page. Fatima, any more?
Yes, Chair, it never ends. The next one revises the content of the audit report in relation to financial statements, and that's on page 13. It's the amendment of Section 20 in the Principal Act. This is a technical one, and the AG can assist if I'm not explaining it properly. But when the AG prepares an audit report of any auditee, it must reflect an opinion, conclusion, or findings on the financial statements of the auditee in accordance with applicable financial reporting framework and legislation. So it's been simplified now, the reason being that the AG's office wants to move away from what they term reasonable assurance engagements on all audits to limited assurance engagements because of the complexity involved, and some auditees would warrant that you would do a reasonable assurance engagement, and smaller ones may warrant a limited assurance engagement. So this is just going to give them some room to choose the type of engagement. But I don't know if you want the AG to perhaps speak to it. It's quite a technical issue.
No, I think we understand it, and I think it's what you were talking about. Depending on the materiality of the audit, I would imagine. I'm saying if it's like you were saying, if it's a small little one-rand business, it doesn't need the same attention as Eskom needs that might have 50 billion. I think that's what you're saying in layman's language, and I think we agree with that. Thank you.
But except that paragraph, that section, it's supposed to also include what we have recommended. Because now we are talking about the audit report, it has to reflect this. Remember what we have been talking about, that why are we focusing on the financial performance and not the other things. I am saying that Section 20 of the Principal Act, now that we have amended it, that an audit report must reflect such, then we mention, and it's all about the finance, it's all about the money, it's still omitting what we've been discussing all along, that it is missing those other elements of non-performance, transgression on whatever issues. It still focusing on finances only. So I am saying, now it means when we do the amendments on that section, we also need to take recognition of what has been said on earlier on the. You remember the clause that I've got here.
Quickly, Chair. Chair, this amendment to Section 20 here, firstly, as was explained earlier, it clarifies what has been put under 2, which is about the opinions that we express on financial statements. But it also goes further, Mam Tubazana, to address those 2 elements. Firstly, under 6A, this is where the pure conclusion on financial statements is. And then the next one on B is on compliance with any applicable legislation relating to financial matters, financial management, and other related matters. Now, that covers the broad non-financial elements of reporting, things like why did these internal controls break down so fundamentally this year? Where was the internal audit function? It is that area that deals with those issues, where you interrogate why did the internal audit function not respond to the recommendations that were raised. Did the council take any steps to deal with it? Kind of inquiry. So that's what B will be about, as well as focusing on the information that has been presented in the annual report purporting to be the achievements of the entity after the monies were spent. So this is effectively putting it clearly now that these are the 3 areas that we are going to report on in order to arrive at an unqualified with no significant findings opinion.
The next one is a very straightforward one. It just says when the AG determines the salary and benefits of the staff in the AG's office, that the AG must now also consider the recommendations of that remuneration committee that was set up.
What you're saying is that the AG's sole discretion, he will be advised by the remunerations committee in terms of salary for his or her staff.
Yes. Exactly.
I think we're happy with that. Yes.
The next one is the simple substitution of the term Deputy Auditor General with Auditor General. So in terms of the current Act, it's the AG that it's the Deputy AG, rather, that establishes and appoints the members of the Audit Committee, and the change now is that that power will now be given to the AG instead of the Deputy AG, and I don't know if they want to explain the reason or not.
No, it was explained in many of our meetings. I think we are happy with that one. That concludes the bill.
No.
The amendments. No.
Okay. No. Then the last one is Section 52, which is the regulation section. That section just broadly says that the AG may make regulations. What we've done now is we've listed the regulations. So now we've said that the AG may regulate on criteria for the discretionary audits. And the nature and category of matters in which it will consider conducting an investigation or doing a special audit if it's requested to do so. And then we made a must in respect of the issue of the recovery of the losses. So the AG now must regulate on the manner and time frames within which a satisfactory explanation must be provided, the format of that certificate, so what it must look like and what the content must be, and the process and time frames within which money recovered must now be deposited into the National or Provincial Revenue Fund. So the reason it's listed is just to ensure that all of this is done, otherwise practically you won't be able to do your recovery process without having these regulations, which is going to be your step-by-step. That's it.
And what's going to happen to the AG's regulations? Do you bring it to SCOAC for,
yes,
for blessings?
Yes, it does.
Is that implied or must it be
no,
in the Act?
No, it's in the already.
It's in the heading already. Okay, so once you've done the regulations, you'll bring them to SCOAC for their blessings before. That's fine.
All right, honourable members, there is the act. Is there any glaring omission? I have one. Maybe it's not glaring, but let me. Is there anything else? Let me repeat what's going to happen. We're going to take this away. We're going to tighten it up as politicians, take it to the National Assembly, and it's going to become law. There's one outstanding matter, is the matter that we've asked you to look at in terms of what Gordy raised earlier on, how do we put that in. So this is the last opportunity that we will have with the AG and the legal and everybody else. Is there anything else that we'd want to put on the table to the AG now, or are we comfortable we'd be able to deal with all these matters behind closed doors? I think that's the question that I'm asking. If we are, then we close this chapter.
Chair, I just want to come back to the issue I raised at the beginning in terms of referrals. We said any appropriate body. Now, if that any appropriate body will include the SIU in the current form of its own legislation, that might actually impede, unless if there is a political understanding or a memorandum with the presidency, that if the AG refers or seeks to refer matters to the SIU, there should be a short-circuiting of the processes. I do think, comrade, that it is a matter that we need to apply our minds to, and not just flippantly, you know, leave it out. I'm fully convinced that to the extent that investigating undesirable audit outcomes does not only talk to issues of financial losses, you need a body that whose focus is not purely and merely criminality, and has an understanding and has the experience and the practice of doing exactly that. And what the implication thereof is, based on current legislation, and what it is that Parliament may need to do to afford the AG that platform to utilize it. Because unlike the public protector or the hawks, you go to the hawks and say, anybody can go to them and say, do this, and they do it. Whereas the SIU has a particular process, and yet I still maintain they are uniquely positioned to be of the greatest assistance to what we seek to achieve.
All right, you'll have the final bite if you want to. There's just two things from my side, AG. And Anna, if it's covered, it's covered. You've, in the past 2 weeks, lamented about this phenomenon of court challenges. Departments don't like your findings, there's court challenges. Is this an opportunity for us to fix that up? Is it fixed up here? The second point is, my understanding would be there's an AG's audit report, it gets signed off. People are not happy with what's contained in that report. Is there a prescribed period that says, well, you know, after 2 months or 3 weeks, I'm going to challenge it? It can't be 18 months later that somebody says, oh, well, we don't agree with the Auditor General and there's nothing that Gordy and his team can do about it. I would imagine there should be a period that says, if you don't challenge it within 18 months or within 18 days or within 18 hours, then that becomes gospel. Because then it, if not done that way, honorable members, all that we're trying to do in terms of oversight is meaningless. Because somebody comes and says, well, this thing, we don't recognize it. We're challenging it. Now, the question that I'm asking, AG, is do we have an opportunity of fixing it up here, or is it something that we must fix up somewhere else? But it can't be that the DG doesn't account, or the minister doesn't account to Parliament, because he doesn't like what the AG has said in his report. Because either two things are going to happen. You're going to have to change your opinion so that they accept it, or we're powerless. So that's my question. And I know Nyami Boy, being a constitutionalist, is going to be saying, but they should be given the right. But it can't be a right forever, Comrade Nyami Boy. You can't forever say, I have the right to challenge. There must be a prescription at some point that says, well, you did have the right, you have forfeited that right. I want you to comment on that, if you want to comment on that. Because you see, AG, I'm as is everybody else, very frustrated as MPs, that you correctly have identified that you don't have teeth. And people out there say, but it's MPs that must give you those teeth. Because really that's what it is. It is us that must give you that teeth to bite. I don't think you're going to get another opportunity to get the teeth that you want to get. I want to be upfront with you. I don't think you'll get another opportunity. So make use of this opportunity. You're not going to get as committed bulldogs like Mente and Boy and Godi and Dubazana. Others might just feel, leave the AG to just be a nuisance or a something. We want you to have real teeth. You're not going to get another opportunity for real teeth. I can assure you that. So is there anything? And my only bugbear in the past 18 months has been people have now moved the goalposts. It never used to happen before that they now challenge you. There might be another one in 18 months' time that they do something else, but if we are serious about fighting corruption, if we are serious about making sure that the resources of the state are used for what they must be used for, then we must close all the gaps and send that message, that we say, Vala, all the gaps. Does this cover that issue? If it doesn't, then I'm saying to honorable members, between now and the 18th, Honorable Godi, Honorable Boy, Honorable McLachlan, let's see what we can do between now, because on the 17th, we're going to have to tighten this thing up. But it can't continue. Baba.
Chair, thanks. I certainly agree that there's something that needs to be done. And as far as the amendments and the proposed amendments are concerned, I certainly do not think that it will be something that can be incorporated in these amendments. It's probably addressing some other teeth elsewhere, I guess, because if they knew that when they come to Parliament, there's going to be no two ways about it, and they didn't submit financial statements, and they are pushing back on specific matters that were identified during the audit, and are using all sorts of other reasons to try not to submit financials. If they knew that Parliament will not tolerate it, perhaps that's what that power I'm thinking of. I'm not too sure to what extent one can write it into the Public Audit Act to actually prevent people not pushing back to the Auditor General. I think many of them must, because sometimes these things that we look at come to a point where some level of judgment must be applied. Either of the parties could have missed some of the most important elements of it, but those situations normally get cleared very quickly. But there are those where you see that actually the issue is about actually not getting any opinion other than the one I want, regardless of the evidence that the auditors have produced. That's what I'm saying. The power of the auditor insofar as dealing with that matter is probably more limited than the power of members of parliament, as it were. So it's probably a case of saying what among the powers of parliament are not being exercised to make sure that anyone, because this the whole process is, it gives us 2 months as auditors, it gives them 12 months to do everything and another 2 months to prepare. Now, the reality is that if there are certain laws or policies that they have set up which they didn't comply with, and on the back of that they want to institute legal challenges to the audit opinion, then I think there's a place for parliamentary committees to act on it. Ours will be to insist that we're not going to sign an opinion that we are not comfortable with based on the audit evidence. And I think there are many cases, Chair, that are at that point as we speak. Many of them are big audits. We haven't signed them because we disagree. Normally the outcome of an audit is a disagreement between the auditor and the auditee. And that's normal. It does happen. It doesn't mean that the auditors must change their view because you don't agree. So I think that as far as these amendments are concerned, Chair, nothing more is needed to realize that. Perhaps it is needed at the level of the parliamentarians. What do they do when an entity... Because once it starts in 1 year, then subsequent years, they almost think that they don't have to submit. And sometimes some of them have got to that point. Like we reported at Scopa the other day, the CCOD, as an example, last submitted in 2012-2013 their financials. And that situation was allowed to continue regardless of the fact that every year there was no financial statement submission to Parliament. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Fatima, and the AG's office. As we indicated, Honourable Macha.
I'm sorry if I'm out of time here, but I just wanted to make a comment because from our side, we don't see the legal process. I've never seen the particulars of claim if anybody wants to come and challenge whatever you've done. But my understanding is that you do your audit, you go back with a management report, you discuss it with the powers that be at the auditee, and eventually you come to a point where you sign off on the audit. And that basically says everybody's in agreement. Whether they like your opinion or not is not what it's about. It's that they accept your opinion. They might not have to like it, but they have to accept it because you're the auditor. Now, when it goes to the next step, when they go to court, what are they actually saying to the court? We don't like what the AG said because, you know, to me, it's up to the courts here. The courts need to rule. Sorry, once the AG has made a decision and that's it, you can't come here and dispute it because you've had your opportunity already. And I think here we need to try and find out what have the courts said, if they've got to that stage already, because to me, it's beyond the ambit of this act to try and say how those outcomes should be, because that's for the court to decide. But I'm just having trouble understanding what is the cause of action when people take you on and say, we don't agree with you, we want to delay this process, we're justified in not filing our reports on time, etc. I just want to hear, is it something that there is any real basis to, or is it just a question of they playing for time? That's the impression I get.
There are two things they normally do in challenging it. Firstly, they say that the opinion that is being proposed must be interdicted from issuing it. That's the number one. And then in some instances, they also ask the court to issue an order for an opinion that's already made to be set aside. Now, I'm not too sure, because the people who are able and responsible for coming to a conclusion on an audit is that team of people who are doing the audit from the time they planned it, right through to execution, right up to evaluating and concluding on it, based on the evidence that they had looked at across the system, the representations that were made by management, and all sorts of other evidence. I have no idea how someone else comes and say this opinion is now no longer the right opinion. So those are the kind of issues that we often face, you know, where we say, well, bring that person then who's got the accumulated evidence on this audit, starting from the knowledge of the business and everything else, and tell us what opinion you want. So we've got one pending, unfortunately, that we might get today, which is pointing to that issue. We have not signed off, if I may, as Chair, on the accounts of SARS, because we have a dispute on a particular matter, and they have chosen that they will take it to court. So we're waiting.
All right. Thanks, AG. Thank you very much to Fatima and her team. Just once again, Comrade Gordy, as... Minta, you want to say something? Yes, ma'am?
Sorry, Chair. What I'm interested to know from the AG is what would be his proposal in terms of what we just discussed now, because if ever a department challenges his authority and the findings, it then becomes another fruitless and wasteful expenditure the following year when the court says you have nothing to challenge these days. So what does he propose we do when he says it's Parliament that must protect him, and of course he's correct, and it's Parliament that must ensure that departments are not utilizing the same money to challenge him. So what is it that he thinks we can do in order, as us parliamentarians, to stop the departments from utilizing our public funds to challenge him, and it becomes another wasteful expenditure.
Short of giving you more work, Chair, if I look at it, we probably need to institute a process from our side where we isolate the real, genuine challenges where there's an interpretation issue that normally can be dealt with, and isolate that from the issues that are just extraordinary. And I think what will trigger what you need to do will be us, as part of the program of interaction between ourselves and SCOWEC, because I think one of the things that's provided for in SCOWEC is to support and to assist the audit office. So support and assist in that context would be to come to you and say, we have been dealing with this matter. As far as we are concerned, all technical possible issues are sorted, but we believe that you as a committee need to engage with us together with this particular auditee to understand what exactly are the issues. Because some of them, they invoke such statements as we probably have an ulterior motive. Now, absolutely difficult to fathom what they have in mind when they say, this particular opinion is driven by an ulterior motive. And I think as a committee that is set up to protect and to support the office, you probably need to hear someone who suggests that there might well be an ulterior motive, because it speaks to the very foundation of what we do. You know, the fact that we've got to do what we do with independence and professional competency. And if there's somebody who's being audited who believes that we are driven by stuff other than that, I think as a committee you need to hear it so that we can be able to say, well, it's probably a figment of their imagination and these are the reasons why we say so. And I think that conversation possibly has never happened in the context of that provision of the Standing Committee on the AG, where at one instance or one or more intervals you might be interested in knowing about some of the issues that might encroach into the execution of the independent mandate of the office, because there are many of them. There are many. Some of them come in the form of pushback, and we certainly know that we are not always right under all circumstances, but there are things that just come up, and you look at them and you say, if you didn't respond to them, they could easily become the habit in the future of ignoring audit conclusions.
Thank you, AG. I think we agree with you that maybe you would need to on a more regular basis, highlight some of these challenges to SCOWEC, and SCOWEC will share them with the relevant individuals, because, by the way, a Chapter 9 institution is set up to support democracy, isn't it? So AG, I think maybe we should give you that task, that in the next 2 weeks, if you can give us a list of those immediate ones. We can't wait, Honorable Gordy, for 18 months down the line, because it becomes a fruitless. If you could say to SCOPA, when we meet on the 17th, Honorable Members, Honorable Gordy, by the 17th we will finalize, and you and your team will be here to finalize it. I think on the 17th we'd want to look at whatever you have, because you are probably the biggest customer. So if AG and your team could give us that report of the pushbacks, not just the one incident that you've raised, but all of them, so that as a team we sit on the 17th and we look at how we sort them out and where we take them to, whether we take them to Speaker or whether we become friends of the AG in court or whatever the case might be, but we will do that. So the 17th. Thank you very much, Honorable Members, and the team. 17th, we will set up a meeting to finalize this. We will expect, Fatima, you and your team to be on standby if we need you. But members will go away and look at this thing. In fact, what we should be saying, were there any amendments that we proposed today that need to be put there, or it's just this document? We were happy with the document. I'm saying in terms of wording. Was there anything that you captured? I never captured anything of wording. If there is, if you could just do that, give us the final document. I didn't see anywhere. I think we were just asking questions of clarity. Was there any changing of wording?
The one, the way we defined accounting officer, we said instead of saying an accounting officer, we should say the accounting officer.
I think that members have taken. That one we can write down. So we will, in other words, we will use this document on the 17th, Honorable Members, together with our final document, and tighten it up. What we also need to do before you go, and I thought you were going to talk to it,
is that on Monday, Fatima, I'm assuming that on Monday you're going to go to Parliament and indicate to Parliament that we are amending the Auditor General's Act. Now, just to bring it to members, it's normally the other way around. You need to first go and ask for permission to do the change. We seem to do both of them simultaneously, but we have done some political work to say, look, please forgive us. We've done them together. It should not be a matter of first doing it and then asking for permission. So what will happen, there's a submission, honorable members, I think you have it in your pack. That submission will go to the speaker. The submission really says, Parliament, we are looking at changing the act. Please give us the permission to go ahead. We've done some political work. I don't think there's going to be any opposition to this. So it means the 17th will be able to carry on because we would have then closed all the gaps. You want to talk to that?
Chair, we must just bear in mind that the 273 permission, we're then going to be limited to exactly what is listed in the permission. So we can't move outside of those amendments. But I think it's quite general enough that it will cover everything. So it's already drafted. The only issue in there was consultation with National Treasury in terms of cost issues. My understanding from the AG's office is that they are expecting the state to bear the additional cost. I think it was 35 million that they won't be doing it themselves. They won't be bearing it themselves. So there just needs to be a consultation process to inform National Treasury.
And who does that? Do we do it at National Treasury? Must we invite Treasury to the meeting of the 17th, or how does it work?
I think we're going to have to do it because it's now going to be a committee bill, so it will be our responsibility. Before the 17th.
Yeah.
Well, before we publish.
It's fine. Can you start some spade work for us to get at our research team if it means that we must take it to whoever? Because there's no executive, isn't it? We're going to have to go and talk to the minister via the speaker. All right? And it's the 33 million you're talking about. All right. Okay. That's fine. If you can do some spade work for us so that we take it through the chief whip, the speaker, whoever it is, so that it eventually gets to... Because if we want to make this thing law in the next financial year, it means we must start, if we're not already late, for the budget process for this year. I mean, for 2017 financial year ending, 2018. Yeah. So if we can speed that one up, I don't know if the minister will be nice to us, but let's start the process, because what I'm understanding is that you can't continue unless you have the money, isn't it? All right.
No, I just heard what Fatima is saying, and I'm just becoming a bit concerned, because if you're saying now that you're going to... If the Parliament says go ahead, it will be only these amendments. And within these amendments, I think I'll be happy if I see the name issuance, the issuance of a certificate, which is not here. It only talks about appropriate body for further investigation. Chair, the first bullet... I am saying I've noted that it does indicate that we empower the Auditor General and to further do investigation to appropriate whatever outcomes for further investigation. But I'm not seeing the way it says the issuance of a certificate, that somewhere will issue a certificate to reinforce that furthering. Actions towards investigations.
Chair, it's later on in the document where we speak about the recovery. So we spoke about recovery generally so that it would allow us to make whatever changes we wanted to make within that idea of recovering the money. So it does appear later on in the document.
Honorable Dumazan, if you look at page 2, and you can tell us if you want us to change it, we can, there's no power. No, I mean, there's no problem. Page 2, the second bullet, where it says amendment sought will seek to, the second bullet point says empower the Auditor General to recover losses in certain instances against the accounting authority I mean the accounting officer or accounting authority accountable for these losses? Do you want to say amongst others by issuing a certificate? Because I'm saying, she's saying it's covered. Will you put that in? It's fine. All right. Okay. So what you are saying is that that one amendment of making allusion to a certificate, you're happy with whatever we're doing. It's fine. Between me and Fatima, we'll try and find a way of putting that one in. We'll submit it to Parliament. On the 17th, we meet again, where we'll finalize this. And in the meantime, we'll also start talking to whoever we need to speak to in terms of soliciting money from the fiscus to make it possible that this act becomes law. Honorable Gordy, and then we will move to the second agenda item. Thanks very much, first of all, Honorable Gordy, Comrade Gordy and your team for coming here and supporting us on this matter. You can stay if you want to stay, but I know we'd invited you just for the session. Thanks very much for you and your team, and we'll expect you on the 17th. Ben, we're not going to send you another invite. On the 17th, you'll be expected to be here to finalize with us. But over to you, Comrade Gordy.
Yeah, thanks, Comrade Chair, and thanks very much for the invite. I can assure you we are more apprehensive about the bill than yourselves. When I say apprehensive, in the sense that the amendments are actually meant to assist our work. So we are more concerned and more into it than merely being visitors. So for me, two things. One, as long as we remember that element that the issuance of certificate must not just be limited to financial recovery. Two, the referral to appropriate bodies. If in our mind these appropriate bodies include the SIU, as I would wish, there has to be additional work done, because if the AG is going to refer to the SIU using the current procedures, it can become self-defeating, because they're too bureaucratic and they will be dependent on whether or not whoever will be president will be amenable to it. But if the Act says the AG has a right to refer, my assumption is that that referral cannot be countermanded. The referral is supposed to be binding to that institution to act. Now, if that is the case, so far as the SIU is concerned, it means that we need to tweak something around there. And I still maintain and insist that it will be the best positioned institution, taking away the current bureaucratic processes to do that work.
Thanks. Thanks, Chair. I'm looking at Ntombi. She's not here. Or even Goli, you can talk to Ntombi. I do think that maybe you must set up a one-on-one between the Chair of Justice, the Chair of SCOPA, and ourselves, just to look at this thing. Because if you're saying there must be changes, the custodians of the SIU is the Portfolio Committee of Justice. So let us have a round table at the chairperson's level and see if it is possible to do that, to strengthen it. Okay. If you could, Ben, just notify Ntombi and I'm saying Coley because Cindy is off sick, but if she's back at that level, you guys can organize something for us. It shouldn't be more than an hour. Thank you very much to the legal team. You'll talk to me on Tuesday you'll change this today. I mean, just change it today and do the necessary, and then maybe next week or so we can get together and see how we plan for the 17th. Thank you very much, Honorable Gordy and your team. You are free to stay. We want to move on to the Audit Committee and thereafter to the AG. And I know it's a Friday. There's no clock in here. It's 11.
Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I think for just to give a better a better advice for Remuneration Committee just to give us the legal presentation, because they never gave us the information. So you're not going to contribute effectively. We didn't read. There's nothing.
Yeah, that's where we wanted to start. Adil, where is Adil? You should know by now, I've worked with you many, many years, that it's just very difficult. Very difficult for us to have a meaningful conversation if we get the documents on the hour. I'm not asking for comment, I'm just saying it is, because I think that's what Honorable Dumazan is saying. And to be consistent, I think she's correct. But members, you would have received this. I'm sure this is what you'll talk to, Chair, on this document.
Chair, our report is actually contained in the integrated annual report. So it's actually been given to the members, yeah. So there's nothing new that we're adding. It's actually just amplifying a few things that you already have. There's absolutely nothing in. Chairman, thanks very much.
Before you do that, do members need to be introduced? I'm sure you've met all of us many times. The chair of the audit committee. Do you need to be introduced? Maybe you should introduce yourself, Chair, to who you are, and if you've come with your team. Your team can stand up or put their hands up so that we can see if they are here, and then members will be comfortable.
Chairman, I'd like to introduce the team. I feel I need protection because we're overpowered by women, Chairman. We've got the two members of the audit committee that are here in addition to myself are Carol Tele and Gretel Mutau. Gretel is a new member, and I'll talk about that, and I'm the chairman of the audit committee of the Auditor General's Office. I'm Peter Moy. Chairman, Our report is on page 89 of the integrated annual report. So there are just a few things that I want to highlight. I guess as a starting point, it's
everybody's got the document. Yeah, fine.
And I guess the single most important thing to take out of our report is that as the audit committee, we are comfortable that the office of the Auditor General is functioning in the way that it is functioning. There is nothing that's really major that we really want to raise to the committee that we are concerned about. Most of the things that would have been raised during the different audits and the different reports were properly dealt with by the office, and we're comfortable that the control consciousness in the organization and the way the office worries about controls is at the right level. So that, for me, that's actually the most important thing that the committee needs to take out of this. I'll cover a few things that are essentially on our report, the purpose of the report, the changes to the composition of the committee, the overview of the activities, and also the external audit appointment, which ultimately is the responsibility of this committee. I'll ask my colleagues to interject if there is anything that I might miss. Our report, Chair, is done in compliance with Section 40, Paragraph 6 of the Public Audit Act. According to the Act, the Audit Committee must, in the audit report, comment on the effectiveness of internal controls and its evaluation of the Auditor General's annual financial statements and may communicate any concerns it may have to the following: the Auditor General, the external auditor of the Auditor General on the oversight mechanism being scored. Let me start off with the changes to the composition of the committee. I've been chairman of this committee for many years. At the end of next week, I step down. I think I've done my national service. Current member John Bisman Simons, who has also been on the committee from the same time as me, will take over as chairman from the 1st of November. Mr. Sathikounden resigned as a member of the committee during the year. A new member, Gretel Mutau, as I mentioned, was appointed in June 2017 to replace Mr. Gounden. So going forward, there'll be three members on the committee: Mr. Bisman Simons, Ms. Raskrut Tsele, and Mrs. Mutau. Over the period under consideration, we received and interrogated information from management and from independent assurance providers in terms of combined assurance. Based on these, we are satisfied, Chair, that the resources and financial expertise in the office are adequate and effective. The systems of internal controls over financial reporting are adequate and can be relied upon for the preparation of annual financial statements. Risk management processes are adequate and operate effectively. On the effectiveness of internal controls, the committee is responsible for overseeing the system of internal control, the financial statements and reporting processes. The committee was able to conclude that the systems of internal controls can be relied upon for the integrity and the reliability of the financial statements, the safeguarding, verification, and maintenance of the organization's assets, the detection of fraud, and compliance with the legislation. We evaluated, Chair, the annual financial statements to consider whether they fairly present the financial position at the end of the financial year, the results of the operations and the cash flow for the period under review. We reviewed the policies and practices for compliance with IFRS, and we reviewed the external audit report. We reviewed management's representation. We considered accounting treatment and any significant unusual transactions, the summary of uncorrected misstatements and accounting judgments. We also met separately with management and independent assurance providers. We reviewed management's assessment of going concern, and we are satisfied that the Auditor General's office will continue as a going concern for the 2017-2018 financial year. Chair, there were some external factors impacting on the Auditor General's office cash flows. And the management have assured us that as a committee, that they are employing appropriate risk mitigation strategies to manage this. This actually was one of the things that we had been concerned about on the cash covers. Not that they were insolvent, but the cash cover ratios. So, having looked at that, we concluded, Chair, that the financial statements fairly present the financial position and the results and the cash flows for the year under review. Chair, we're also responsible for looking at internal audit. We commissioned an internal audit external quality assessment review, and the outcome of that will inform the internal audit strategy going forward. We reviewed and approved the annual internal audit plans and fees. We considered the reports of the internal auditors. We reviewed their observations and recommendations, and we engaged with the internal auditors in closed sessions. and obtained comfort regarding the coordination efforts between the internal and external auditors. We are satisfied of the existence of the adequacy and the effectiveness of risk management, internal controls and governance processes, having done that. On the external auditors and their independence, we are also satisfied with what they do after having looked at their own representation. We looked at the quantum of work undertaken by the external auditors relative to the office of the Auditor General, because if they are earning far too much fees relative to their total income, they might lose their independence. We looked at their audit plans, including their audit fees, and we reviewed the external auditors and the quality of their processes, and we were satisfied. Chairman, we also looked at the sustainability and predetermined objectives. The committee reviewed the internal audit reports as well as the external audit opinion on the predetermined objectives and sustainability, and received assurances that material disclosures were reliable and did not conflict with the financial information. The one thing that I said is really the responsibility of this committee on our recommendation is the appointment of external auditors. The contract between Quinana and Associates and the office expired and will not be renewed, as they did not meet one of the conditions that was set by the office on the appointment. We actually needed to ensure that we had a firm that had sufficient number of partners. It is important, Chairman, that this office is actually audited by a firm that when anybody looks at, they can actually say they've got the critical mass and skill to conduct such an audit. And we've actually given them an extension, and they confirmed to us that they'll not meet that. So at the conclusion of the audit of the financial year ended 31st March, their contract came to an end. So went through a process and advertised for new auditors. Initially, we did not receive any bids on time, and we received one bid post the closing date. So we re-advertised, and we still only received one bid. We are still looking at that. But ideally wanted to come to you with a recommendation right now. We're still in the process of looking for a firm, but it is important that we try and conclude this for the sake of the proper functioning of the office, that this is done by the end of November, and on our side, we'll actually try and do that. I just want to highlight to the committee why it's never easy to find a firm or suitable firms to do the audit. It's not that there are no good audit firms in our country. There are a lot of very good firms. Most of them do work for the Office of the Auditor General in other spheres. And as a result of that, we don't prefer to appoint them as external auditors, because they get a substantial amount of work out of the office. So we actually prefer that the firm that audits the office does no other work for the office. That's really our challenge, and that's why it's never easy. In fact, I always dread every time we have to go out on tender. That really is the problem, Chairman. That's the end of our presentation. That's actually really the one thing that was not in our report. Thanks. I'll take questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moyo. Anybody else on there? Happiness at the back? Yeah. All right, honourable members, there's the audit committee's report. Any comments on the audit committee's report? Mam Dubazana and then Sismente.
Thank you, Chair. I do understand that the Queen Anne Affair because of some poor performance that was picked up by yourself. But now I'm just worried if the Queen Anne Chair terminated the service in March and this is November. What happened to the Auditor General's office, the work that was supposed to be done by the Queen Anne? Are you aware what is happening to that canoe? That is the first thing. And secondly, these are very scarce resources in our country, and you are all aware, Chair, that these are very, very scarce in the whole country. To get those friends that are there, they are there, but I'm sure they've got enough work to do. Now, the process of, like, headhunting, if we've advertised twice, because advertising on its own, it's expensive, and you only get one person. So headhunting, if we can get a clarity, Chair, is what is there anything that is forbidding you to do that?
Thanks, Chair. Notwithstanding the fact that they are presenting on as a finance committee. But on page 5, where they're indicating that resources and financial expertise are adequate and effective. And then what comes to mind is that in terms of resources, I don't think they are adequate in the AG's office due to the fact that you have to use partners to assist you with your work, like you are saying now that some of the external firms already are committed with the work that the Auditor General gives them to audit for you in other spheres of government and also national government. So is there something that you are doing in order to capacitate to have your internal audit people more than the external auditors? I don't know if I'm making sense. To limit the outsourcing and have at least our own auditors that are much more reliable than the external auditors, because I feel that in terms of resources, you are not resourced enough if you're still using external people.
Well, we'll take many more, because remember, we are asking you these questions. We probably ask the AG, and we know if you ask the AG, we're talking to somebody that's going to have a particular view because he's the AG. We're asking these of you because you're external. And then you'll respond to them. Any more? Or you're supposed to be independent anyway. Any more comments? No? If not, let me raise two. Just to follow up on what Honorable Mente is saying. Mr. Moyo, you say that the AG is a going concern, he's financially viable and all that. And yet we know, and we'll probably pick up in the AG's report when we talk to him just now, there's always this concern about the huge debtors book. The huge debtors book. And unless we address that, there is the risk that the AG could be in trouble. Whether it's deliberate sabotage, because if I'm going to get a terrible audit report, I just don't pay audit fees, or I don't have the money because I don't have a tax base. So how do you reconcile either going concern with that? If that's just a small amount of it, that's fine. The second point that I want to make to you again, and maybe it's good that you're resigning tomorrow. When did you say tomorrow?
Friday. Next week.
Friday. Yeah. Maybe it's good you're resigning Friday next week, so you won't be scared of saying it. You know, from where I sit, you should regard SCOAG as the shareholder of the Auditor General. You know, in a department or ESCOM, the shareholder is the executive. You don't have a minister. So we are really the shareholder, and I'm asking you from that capacity. It's no secret that KPMG has created and or has
raised lots of interest. To the extent that even Parliament has terminated them, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, Parliament has terminated, not Parliament, the Palmer, I think it was, or somebody like that. AG, when all this happened, went out and he said, we will continue to use KPMG. And I'm sure members will raise that when they talk to the Auditor General just now. But as an audit committee, that's what I'm saying, maybe they shouldn't have been here when they asked it, but politics is not about popularity. I don't care if they think that we are nasty people. We have to ask it. Do you want to make a comment on the wisdom or otherwise of the AG continuing to use KPMG? He'll respond when we get to him, but I'm asking you as an external person, the wisdom or otherwise, because we're the shareholder. We must make a comment on it one way or the other as the shareholder. What is the wisdom of the AG saying that? He will respond for himself. I don't want you to defend him because he's coming in next. But what is your view?
Okay.
So if you could answer those three questions or four questions, and then we'll move on to the AG if we are happy with it. But thank you anyway for your presentation, Bob.
Chairman, thanks. All of those are a very good question, and I'd like to also invite my fellow committee members to chip in. Firstly, I just want to be clear, the issue around Kwinana was not a performance issue. Part of the terms of the appointment was that they had to have a minimum of five partners as a firm, so that, because that gives us the comfort that they've got enough breadth and capacity to conduct our audit. And they were not able to do that. We gave them time, in fact, with a series of meetings with them and said, look, this was the condition of your appointment, and we can't really change it. We allowed them time to fix it. They were not able to, and they came to us and said, they'll not be able to. And then we told them beforehand that if they did not fix it by given time, we had no choice but to go and change auditors. And even when we advertised, if they'd had five partners, they could actually have applied, and it would have been much easier for us to continue them. But they couldn't. So it had nothing to do with the performance. And I just want to assure the committee that we're comfortable with the level and the quality of their work. On the question of headhunting, you possibly were reading our minds. Last night we talked about it, that if this is what we are seeing, let's really think about maybe going to approach IRPA and say, give us a list of firms and we will actually invite those firms, I mean, if they are not doing work for the office, to apply, because it is actually important that we apply our minds properly. So it's something that we are considering. On the resources in the office not being sufficient, I think we need to separate two things, but I will delve into an area that I normally say it is not our concern. We've got to separate the office as functioning as the management of the office and the performance of the audit. The accounting officer that we really look at is the DAG. The conducting of the audit, one of the things that I've consistently said is that the audit of any state institutions is actually a preserve only of the Auditor General, and the Auditor General must not take instruction from anybody, including the audit committee, because he must actually do his job without any interference. It is the Auditor General that chooses whether to outsource the work or not outsource the work, given what they need in the office to conduct the audits. I think I am right in saying that over the years, we've actually seen the insourced work, i.e. the work done in the office, growing faster than the work that's outsourced. I think I'm right on that one. So it's actually planned. So it's that level of resourcing is actually planned to use external providers. That's actually part of their plan, because part of it is actually the number of audits that have to happen at the same time. So if you are not careful, if you actually staff for those peak periods, you'll end up at times having a whole lot of people sitting in the office doing nothing, because most of the errands are much. So it's also just balancing the staffing requirements. What we're talking about are the financial resources in the management of the office. So if you look at the accounting staff, the finance staff, the HR staff, the people that run the effectiveness of the office, that's really where we need to comment on. So our conclusion is based on that. We do review the levels of when it comes to the fees, the levels of work. There was a question on the planning. Sorry, you had a question on. It was the same question, I think, on how this gets planned. You had two questions, I thought. Sorry, okay.
No, it was exactly that, and how is it planned, the audit time? But partly you covered it, that because of the peak time of the auditing, this is where you resort to, and then because of the rest of the year, there's nothing to do, people sit in office.
And I really want to stress that we will be totally out of order if we actually started getting involved on the actual. I always say the auditor general's office is like a judge. When we start telling them how to make their decisions, I personally get worried. Going to the chairman's question around the huge debtors book, and we're saying that it is a going concern. If there are a few things that one has to look at when you look at a going concern. The first, and it's not always very instructive, is the solvency, i.e. your assets versus your liabilities. The assets of the Auditor General's office at the end of the year were higher than their liabilities. So it is the office is in a solvent position. Then one has to look at the liquidity, the ability for the office to pay its obligations or discharge its obligations as and when they arise. We looked at the cash flows, we looked at the cash cover ratios, notwithstanding the size of the debtors book. We actually believed, if we looked at the cash conversion over time, and we actually looked at their cash focus, and we looked 1 year forward, we were comfortable that for a year. But I guess, Chair, you are raising a fundamental question that over the years we've actually spoken about, that we need to find a way, and we've raised this to the committee, that we really need to find a way that people cannot just choose not to pay for their audits, because there is here an issue around our democracy, that we can't allow the office to fold because people are not paying. When you recall that we've even asked that we consider a straight appropriation from finance for the different entities, so that this is dealt with. The size of the book and the delays in the payments are a concern, but we are comfortable that the office is doing everything it can to ensure that they collect the debtors. On the question of you as the shareholder, and I'll get to KPMG, over the years we've actually said for the purposes of our work, we really need to look at SQUAD as the shareholder, and we do. And in fact, that's actually also one of the reasons why we always say that even the appointment of auditors, I know it is the law, we actually can't do it as the audit committee, just like in any company. You go and recommend that to the shareholders. So we do actually look at this, and in fact, we take this very seriously. In fact, I had to move out of our own board meeting to attend this. That's actually how seriously we look at SCOAG. Chair, on the question of KPMG, I do have my own views, and in my own company, I've espoused on those views. Certainly, the way KPMG conducted themselves does not, in my mind, accord to the values that one would like to see from a professional firm. I think that's point number one. Then, does one continue using them? And by the way, my own firm, or my own company, I'm the CEO of All Mutual, we are using KPMG, and I'll share with you what we've done. We've insisted that they have an independent review. A part of the things that they did were actually the things that we asked them to do. Firstly, we said when their international firm was looking at what had happened in South Africa, they must set aside the firm and actually conduct that review independently and report to the international body, not through South Africa, which they did. We're comfortable with the actions they took. Some of the things were slightly disappointing, because I would have thought that if it's an issue of ethics, you don't pay people to go. So that bit was disappointing. Then the question that one had to ask, is the rot totally in the firm, in the whole firm? Or it was actually a few bad apples and we're taking out those apples. So the independent review, which they are now doing, and SAICA are now involved with it, is also something that we were the first to say, as part of us continuing with them, they're to do that. And we've said we need them to really look very deep into the organization. And if the rot goes deep into the organization, I think people must not have an option but not to carry on with them. But if it's a few bad apples, I think they should actually be allowed. And so I think the stance that has been taken by the office is that let's actually wait for this independent review. And I think one needs to assess the position after the independent review. And one needs to be careful here. Some of you might remember the bulking scandal at Alexander Forbes. And I'd actually just taken, when it hit us, I'd just taken over as the CEO of Alexander Forbes. I was totally new to the job. I had nothing to do with it. I shuddered to think what would have happened if the firm had actually been shut down, when the 7,000 people that worked in that organization, the majority of them were very, very good people, did not even know what was happening. And my view, Chair, is one needs to look at whether that's what's happening at KPMG. If the rot has gone down, shut down the whole thing, don't do any work with them. But if it's a few bad apples and they've been pruned, I think it's actually that stance I'll still support the stance. So I am personally comfortable with the way the office of the AG has worked. It is certainly in line with what the All Mutual Group has has chosen to do, and we never had any consultation with the office. So differently, I suspect we came to more or less the same conclusions. So I'm comfortable. I don't know whether my colleagues.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Just to add on the going concern, just to indicate that the Deputy AG did present, did table to the Audit Committee the assessment of the going concern formally, which the Audit Committee interrogated. Just to highlight just two things, which we believe is key. The Auditor General had cash of 553 million as at the end of March 2017. That cash is projected to be at 485 million, slightly below the 553 million. However, the Deputy AG is satisfied that the 485 million would be able to be met on the basis of two key things. The one is the improvements in the collection efforts, that includes the engagements with the National Treasury, as well as the litigation methodologies that have been implemented. That then gets the auditees to then act on the fees when they have to pay. And the second thing is about the cost optimization. That also includes the new audit methodologies that have been implemented. You would have seen, Chair, that in the integrated report, there were some costs that were incurred in order to improve the audit processes and systems within the Auditor General. All that will improve in terms of the processes for the Auditor General going forward, and that will then enhance going concern. And the Audit Committee was satisfied with it. Thank you, Chair.
Anybody else? No? Let me just ask the final question on that one. I think if you can't respond to it because I'm ambushing you, then say so. This litigation that you're talking about, in terms of debt recovery, do you have an idea of the quantum in terms, in other words, how many cases? And do you have an idea? If you don't, it's fine. If you don't, it's fine. Let me put it differently. As the shareholder, we'd be interested in the quantum in terms of how many cases there are. And also, if you won all those cases, how much money you'd get back. You know, there's two reasons why we'd raise that one. One, obviously, because of the going concern to satisfy ourselves. But members also, I mean, at some point, remember those that are getting litigated are government departments. It's almost like the brother charging the sister, and so on. It can't be an ideal situation. That although you're not government, but it's almost like the state charging each other. You understand what I'm saying? It's a different story if there's a liability with a private sector somebody, and it's not your problem. I think you must continue to collect your money. But at the political level, we just have to find a way that deals with this matter for two reasons. One is, like I say, within the family. But secondly, honorable members, it's, as I was saying earlier on, Chairperson Moyo, you know, if I know that when the AG walks in here, he's going to pick up a lot of corruption and undesirable stuff, and then I must still pay him for doing that job tomorrow, I'll just plead poverty. I'll just plead poverty so that he doesn't even come in here. Not because I'm poor, but because if he comes in, he's going to pick these things up. Now I'm saying, I'm hoping that there's no unscrupulous people that work in local government or province or national. I'm just saying that we mustn't pretend as if we're in heaven. If there are institutions that want to do that,
they will do that. And that's why I'm saying at a political level, I think we just need to find a way. And that's why, ma'am, I'm saying to you, just give us an idea. Because, you see, that idea will help us. I mean, if, AG, if the people that are not paying you, we know that these are people who are serial disclaimers, then we've got a problem. Then we have a problem that we know that this institution never gets a clean audit. They're not paying the auditor general. It might not be your problem, but it's our problem. That's why it's important that we get that list. I'm saying over and above the list that you're going to give us for the 17th, in terms of the pushbacks, can we have your top five litigants or whatever you want to call them, those that, in terms of how long are we struggling to get money out of municipality Vincent Smith? Do you understand what I'm saying? Or the debtors book. Municipality Vincent Smith owes us money for 18 years. It's not just current debt. If you could give us that thing, then we will be able to play our role. But thanks. And again, don't answer us if you can't, but if we could get that by the 17th. If you can answer it, it's fine. If you can't, by the 17th, if that information is submitted to Cindy or the team, so that we deal with it. But over to you. If you want to respond, it's fine.
Chairman, thanks. Firstly, you raise a valid point, and this is something that we've gone through. In fact, it's slightly worse than brother taking brother to litigation. It's almost like litigating against yourself. That's how serious this thing is, because it's actually one arm of the government litigating another against another arm of government. So in this sense, it is the government of the Republic of South Africa against the Republic. So one has to think about it like that. So going the litigation route is always the last resort, having gone through. I do not have the list, but I think at the end of the year, there were about 79, I've just checked with the DG, about 79 people that lawyers' letters had been sent to. Not that it was litigation. It's actually lawyers' letters threatening that if they don't do that. So when you end up sending a lawyer's letter to yourself or sending a lawyer's letter to your wife when you're still married, it's slightly problematic. And that's actually how seriously we've got to look at this. But I think it's something, Chairman, that we've raised, that possibly we need a political solution on this, because this is, TOTA has got the risk of derailing our democracy, because if people choose not to pay for audits when it's an essential cornerstone of our democracy, we will be selling our country short. So it's something that maybe SCOWAC needs to really look at and think about. We've raised it a few times.
That's the absolute last one to the Audit Committee? Oh. Yeah, for the 17th, it's fine. Do you want to raise the Audit Committee before we release them? Yes, sir?
Sorry, sir. Just, if I may, I just wanted to ask, did you do a comparative study on the fees charged by the Auditor General to his auditees as relating to the private sector? And again, then, how do they relate to the fees you charging the Auditor General for the work you do? Can you give us just an idea of how that works?
Well, we are the audit committee of the... We are not the auditors. So our fees, we must actually think of... Our fees, you must actually think about them almost like board fees. And having sat on many boards, it's actually a very, very small fraction of what you'll get sitting on a board. But the fees that are paid to the members of the audit committee, I think, are exactly the same as what a partner in an audit firm gets. But we also do understand that part of it is quite frankly national service. Just to give you an example, for us, I mean, all of us live in Joburg, for us to be here for the whole, having come yesterday to today for an external auditor, we'll be charging all that time. We actually say to ourselves when we come to Cape Town, you can't actually charge more than 4 hours for your traveling time, and then the time that, so we actually control it. Even if it takes me 2 hours to get to the office in Pretoria, we've been clear that we don't charge, that we've actually been very, very controlled in actually what we do. And quite frankly, none of us have really done it. None of us have done it for the money. So it's not something that we've... And I can assure the committee that those fees are way lower than what one normally gets sitting on a board. And the Auditor General fees, the charge-out rate, they've got a standard. They've got a standard rate that they use for all the firms. In fact, what the government auditees are charged is normally also a lower rate. They are charged at a lower rate than what commercial companies were charged. I can tell you straight that if some of the big state-owned entities where the audit is total outsourced to the big firms, if that was done by the Auditor General, those rates will be lower. And by the way, I'm not leaving because I don't like the fees.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson and your team. Thank you very much. Honourable members, our next agenda item...
Chairman, may we please be excused if... Okay.
That's what we were going to say to members, that we will excuse the AG, the Audit Committee. We've heard enough, AG, we don't want you here. We'll excuse the Audit Committee. Honourable members, we had given the AG from 10:45 until about 11:45, quite frankly. It was about 2 hours. We've got an hour left, I think. I'm looking at my watch. And I don't know, AG, how much... And I think I had, if memory serves me correctly, I think we had said to the AG we're going to give you about an hour to present, I think, and we'd ask you to forward that. I'm looking at members. If I live up to that, it means the AG is going to present until 1. And then there's still about up to 1:30 for us to engage, if we want to engage. That's the reality, because I think our discussions were important, the ones that we've had up to now. The other alternative is for us to find some other time just to deal with the AG's one. I know the AG's time is money, and it's about reliability, not reliability, availability, but I don't want to go through the AG's report as a malicious compliance. Just do it because we want to do it. We do a disservice to him and the work that he's put in, and a disservice to members who have taken the time to read it. I don't know. That's why I'm looking at you, and AG, you'll also have to indicate, because, of course, I'll defend that it was not fruitless expenditure, because, I mean, half of the work that we were doing related to the AG, I know you brought other people in here, but I'm able to defend it. I'm just not sure. I'm looking at Kuno and other people. How do we take this thing forward? We've got an hour. We had indicated to AG yesterday or on Monday in our preparatory meeting that we'll give him about an hour. And I'm sure their presentation is about an hour. But for him to present and then for us to ask questions because our one eye is on the plane, just does a disservice to everybody. And to send the AG away and he might not be available until the 17th might be the other problem. So I'm looking at all of us for some sort of a solution. If people want to, me personally, I can work until 12 tonight if I have to. But I know the reality is that members are not going to be able to do that, and some of you might not be able to do that. Maybe we should start with you first, AG. What is your view? And then we can impose it on members if that's the case. Just that, like I said, it's an hour, and it's really our fault. the way we manage the meeting, but can we have an indication from you?
Chair, thinking now as you're asking, I was thinking that with the comprehensive feedback that you got from the chair of the audit committee on these financial statements and the annual report, I think that is a starting point in terms of the key things that you probably would be looking for. I'm sure between now and 10 minutes for me to just give an overview of what's contained in the annual report will be sufficient. And then I think at a next opportunity, the DAG, who would have gone through the detail of the different elements of what's in here, can then take the opportunity to do that the next time around, after we've at least painted the two contexts, one for the audit committee and maybe for me just to give an overview for 10 minutes. And the discussion will then ensue after the DAG has had a chance to give the more detailed thing in terms of the feedback on the annual report. I would propose that, Chair. At least that can take us up to, say, quarter past at the latest.
All right. DAG, how do you feel? I'm just thinking about it so that we don't disrupt everybody's life, and you will get an opportunity also to respond after the DAG. If we take AG's proposal, we will squeeze time on the 17th if necessary. I don't know. That's how I was calling you. I don't know what's our agenda on the 17th. I'm saying at the absolute latest, where DAG can take us through the whole process, because she's the one, she's the accounting officer, as I understand it. Or if DAG, if you are available at the earlier date, just indicate it, and then between the team we'll look at members and find it, even if it means after hours, but it's up to you. And then we'll allow members to comment. Proposal on the table is that we give the AG 15 minutes to give an overview from his side. The in-depth discussion, we'll hear what DAG says in terms of availability. The worst-case scenario will be the 17th of November, when we are scheduled to meet anyway. But if DAG is available in between those times, you'll give us 2 or 3 days, and we'll try and solicit it with members to see if they're available. But we'll come back to you.
Chair, I'm quite happy to go along with that proposal. My availability is not as tight as the AG, so I would be able to make myself available to the committee to have the more detailed conversation on this.
Thank you very much. Members, how do you feel? Is it fine if we just give the DAG overall? And if there's 1 or 2 questions, we can take the 1 or 2 questions. But the real in-depth one will be with deputy. No problem. And then we'll find a relevant time between ourselves, and we will consult with you. But it will not be later than the 17th of November, where we'll take through the annual report, strat plan, and everything else. So DAG will be in touch with you via a deal, which is the normal procedure, isn't it? Adil? Yeah. All right. Okay, AG. You're free to go. Oh, you wanted to say something?
No, I wanted us to leave. And thanks, Chairman.
Oh, you're
no, also, no, no. Yeah. Thanks for the support that the committee has gotten over the, has given to the audit committee over the years, and I'm sure you'll continue giving the committee all the support. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. You are free to go.
Thank you.
Okay, AG, it is just before, if my watch serves me, it's just before 12. Can we give the AG about 15 minutes? You said you need 10, about 15 minutes. It'll take it to quarter past 12. We still might have 10 minutes and still allow you, Dubazane, to leave at half past 12. But the in-depth one would be later on. AG, over to you, sir.
Quick one, Chair. I probably will do a variation of what is in the original slides now, seeing that we have changed the direction a bit. Chair, just as an overview, if one looks at our strategic plan that we have been driving as an audit office and what we are reporting on per this annual report, if I take you to page 4, that's probably the page that I'll deal with for the next 10 minutes. On this page, Chair, at the beginning, after the end of the last strategic plan, which we started, which we wrapped up to the end of 2014-2015 year. The one that we are busy with now, which is the 15-16 and 16-17, is the second year into this strategic plan that we are implementing under the current term of the AG. So we are reporting to you, therefore, taking into account that all of the deliverables that we had committed up to the point of the end of the previous AG's mandate is now 2 years in the making. And the key things that are contained in this cumulative effect of our implementation over these past 2 years, including the previous period, is the fact that we are still pursuing a journey as an office to influence the development of robust financial and performance management systems in government. We are still, as our strategic plan says, that we want to also be part of strengthening oversight and accountability over financial management disciplines to drive and to communicate the importance of a commitment and ethical behavior by all, as well as a value-adding assurance provider in the form of the AG as an office that leads by example. So those key goals, Chair, which we had set out to drive over the next couple of years, we believe that many of them are still on course. We think that the discussion that we've just had, which was one of the key enablers that will drive us down this journey, is the discussion we've had earlier on regarding the review of the powers of the office. Many of those issues we discussed are all revolving around making a change substantially in a number of these areas. We've chosen, Chair, as is clear in our strategic plan and our annual report, that the four focus areas that we drive is the value-adding auditing, is the visibility for impact, the viability of the institution to continue to operate, as well as the vision and values driven through the organization. So what you'll find in the detail of the annual report as you go through the detail and as the Deputy AG will take you through it will be further articulation of how we have fared over the last year in terms of this annual report on those four key strategic objectives. The one on value-add auditing, for example, will give you an insight into how are we expanding the focus of the audit effort, what are the things that are coming out from the entire system, whether you look at departments nationally, provincially, entities, as well as local government. But also you'll find also in that value-adding part some issues that we are flagging which we believe could bring about a quick and fast improvement in the area of managing of finances in the public sector, as well as on reporting on their performance. One of the other things, Chair, in the second goal, which is the visibility for impact, is the issue about our interactions on an ongoing basis with either portfolio committees, with the standing committees on public accounts, with APEC, with many other instruments, both in the executive and on the legislative side, where our job is not necessarily to leave a report on the table, but to take further steps through that report in order to engage the people who are charged with the responsibility to effect oversight over the financial instruments. Among other initiatives that we will also be reporting on an ongoing basis, part of which is also reported on here, is that in addition to the audit work that we do in order to sign off our audit reports, we also do the likes of your quarterly key control engagements so that we can become part of a mechanism to also identify at an early stage the type of issues that cause either finances to be lost or issues that cause for there to be uncertainty as to what has happened to some of the resources allocated. So this Visibility for Impact program is part of what our staff across the office do on a quarterly basis to go and interact with accounting officers and those that are charged with financial management on some of the issues that normally come out in audits. We would discuss issues of how frequently do you appraise your accounting records to assess whether they are being performed properly, as well as whether they provide for fair safeguard of the resources in the organization we audit. And then the third one, still on page four of these slides, Chair, is the viability part. And this is really where we start assessing the appropriateness of our skills, the need for us to continue to provide ongoing technical training and development to our staff so that they can become more alert to the risks that they are confronting in the area in which we audit, as well as to also make sure that we continue to have access to the resources that we need, both human and financial. We had a discussion earlier about the risks associated with having limited access to the resources. as well as an enabling legal framework that allows us to do the things that we think will narrow the space for ongoing deficiencies to go unattended. Competencies, Chair, as well as building an ongoing culture in the office also influences the viability of the office in the future. Because when we see the effort that we put into it now, we also need to safeguard the continuity of the institution, the attractiveness of the institution to people who might want to come and train as auditors, as well as provide this service even in the next 10, 20, 30 years when many of us are no longer doing it. So that's what the viability part of the reporting for the annual report is about, is to give you a sense of what sort of capabilities do we have, what are the resource issues, physical and many other forms of resources, so that we don't wake up one day and say, you can't do these things anymore according to the mandate, because we no longer have access to those tools as well as the facilities and other things that are necessary to perform an audit. So there's a whole range of issues, therefore, under viability, Chair. It's a flood of them, and you'll see in the report there are a couple of things that we are reporting on. We are reporting on the effort we are putting into funding people who are at tertiary institutions to support them towards attainment of the professional qualification with a view to retaining them in the institution. But some of them, they obviously go to other institutions in the public sector to work there. And the fourth one is also about saying there are certain rules that also apply to us that we need to live by in order for us to continue to claim the license to operate. So the essence of what is therefore in our report, Chair, overall, is built around these four strategic goals that we drive as an institution, where we look at all the different elements that make for an audit institution that continues to enjoy the level of independence that is necessary, but also continues to be alive to the fact that we have to continuously lubricate the machinery in order for it to continue to run. And there are certain rules that also we need to observe, which we are reporting on in the report. So as the Audit Committee Chair has said, Chair, it won't be necessary for me to add to some of the observations that he has made overall. He made them here in our presence in terms of their assessment of how we have fared in all of these four areas. As I said earlier on, the only thing that's missing is questions and detail, as in how much have you spent here, why have you spent this year, and that's the part that the Deputy AG will deal with overall. But in terms of our context, as far as the audits are concerned, we have tried and have succeeded in many ways to bring the message across to all of those entities that we audit, but we are very encouraged by the support as well, which moves in the direction of saying, if you were used to ignoring audit recommendations in the past, it looks like the committee is agreeing with us that maybe the days for those are numbered. So that's where we are, Chair, as far as those four goals are concerned, and we are excited with the new responsibilities that I think will be coming our way. I might add as well that we have been, while you were engaging with the review of our powers, we've also been simultaneously interacting with our staff in the office just to alert them to the possible new environment that they will be operating in, so that they don't get taken aback and start questioning how and why they certain things have to be done. So while we are busy with this process, we are also in the office trying to make sure we align people and get them ready for the prospect of the outcome of the exercise around the review of the office. But generally, Chair, we, like other organizations, are affected by things as they change in the environment in which we audit, and we continue to have a risk-intelligent environment that is able to respond to some of those things as and when they happen. Let me leave it at that, Chair, and hope that that provides an additional context to how we've performed in the past year, and as I said, the bulk of the inner detail of the main operational side of things, the DAG will be able to cover that at a later time. Thanks.
All right. I'll allow members. Really, the detail we'll interact with the deputy. But if there are high-level strategic areas that you'd want to cover, and it doesn't mean that if we've covered them, we can't cover them again when the DAG is here. But if there's anything that you'd want to raise or hear from the horse's mouth, so to say,
from AG himself, I will allow you to do that. Honorable Dlamini.
Thank you, Chair. It's just, I think it's for our side more than the AG and the team regarding the appointment of the external audit, like it was reported by the committee, the remuneration committee. Whether what are we saying as are we what are we saying as a committee on that? Are we giving them the go ahead of appointing the external audit, or they are doing they have to do the head hunting?
All right. No, that is our own one. I think the understanding is that they'll go and do the head hunting by the end of November. They will have finalized, but they still have to bring it back to us for our blessing. So it will come to us. That's how I understand it. But if it's different, you can. Just the high level AG, and I suppose the deputy will be able to justify or motivate it if needs be later on. We've been saying this for many years, and we agree that I know Walter Sisulu has been one of them and others, where you physically go and headhunt or give opportunities to students either to come and work for you or do their articles or vice versa. The question that I'm asking is, should we not take it a step lower? And I'll tell you why. I mean, should we not be talking to Standard 9, so I don't know what normal standard in my day or Standard 9, grade 11, huh? Yeah, grade 11 and grade 12. Because I think that's where we should be saying to people, these are the opportunities. I mean, you can't go to somebody at university and say maths and science is important. You say that to them when they're in grade 6 or grade 7. Why? That's just the one question, just at a broad level. Because that will then talk to turnover, retention, and all those type of things. I mean, what is our turnover? What is our retention? And I know we talk about it every year, so that's the one. The second one also, AG, and I'm sure it's in here because I know you talk about it, but you must just give us a sense before we get into it. And it's difficult to ask you because I suppose you're not going to shoot yourself in the foot, but if you, to the extent that you can, what is your quality control audit saying to you? I mean, are we comfortable as the AG's office that we've got the requisite capacity and skills to do a proper audit, whether it's at local, national, provincial, or is there an area that we can improve on? Just and your quality control, I'm sure, would be able to tell you that. Because all of us live in our constituencies. You know, I welcome it. I'm from a metro in Johannesburg, where many, and even the province for that matter, where many departments have benefited from your staff. They now CFO in Joshco, CFO in the city parks or something like that. Is that not the risk? And I know that we need to empower those people. But what is the risk to you? That's what I'm saying, is our recruitment commiserate, English is tough, with our sending people out. So that's the second one. And then, of course, the final one, AGA, it will be unfair not to give you rights to respond to. I'm just so sorry that my mother never taught me to be diplomatic. I say things as I see them. Tell us about this KPMG story of yours. Tell us about it. We're not going to pronounce one way or the other, but I do think that it would be just wrong of us not to say to AG, but what's going on in your head? We've asked this one, let's ask you, and then members will discuss it when we need to discuss it. So those would be the three for me. The quality control, are we comfortable? The retention / recruitment, and I'm suggesting that maybe we should go further than just first-year varsity students, or go lower. And then, of course, do you want to add to what Chairperson Moyo said on KPMG? Any other members that want to? Honorable Mentor? Remember, it's really for the AG, but the AG can help, but we'll have another round for anybody else that wants to talk to. No? Okay, Honorable Mentor?
Thanks, Chair. Now, it will still be on the outsourcing as the audit committee said is the AG's call. And my concern then becomes because of the peak times of the year and the times when it's quiet. But I'm worried about the pricing. As much as we are told, it's lower when it comes to the AG's office than it is in SAA and Eskom. But then when you look at the costing of the external people, vice versa, your internal capacity or your internal people, is it far different? Is it lesser when you outsource? Or is it more when you insource? Can we just get your view there?
Just for my sake, also, Honourable, I think I hear what you're saying. When you're saying is it more or less, are you saying to the AG or to the customer? Let me put it in my understanding. AG uses Price Waterhouse. Let's assume it uses Price Waterhouse. Are you saying, are you asking how much Price Waterhouse charges the AG to do the work, or how much Price Waterhouse charges the department? How much it charges the AG? Just for my own sake, for clarity.
Now, it's how much does Price WaterCoopers charges the AG for the work compared to when the AG has employed a full-time person? Is it higher when you charge when you employ full-time, or is it lower when you are using the services of the outside people?
I know it got this. I hope you understand the question. All right. Any more questions? We'll take one round of questions. Anybody else wants to pose a question? Otherwise, we will reserve all other questions for DAG when we meet with her later. But AG, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me deal with the question on the support that we provide to tertiary students. That support is in addition to our school's program, which basically runs across the country. So you'll have people in our Mpumalanga business unit and Western Cape, Eastern Cape, and all that. There are certain scheduled interactions that take place with that level of students to expose them to the accounting discipline, to provide them whatever necessary support they might have in making choices, because at that point they need that level of encouragement. So our staff who have gone through the journey are normally the ones that are going around that, but we do have some report on our footprint in that area in our annual report. Now, dealing with the issue of the quality control and our audits, Chair, just in terms of a discipline internally, every year we subject our audits that we select through a quality control process. That is obviously the tail end of the process after reports are signed. And from that, we have looked at it, and if one looks at the past four years, we were hovering around 86% overall in terms of the outcome of that quality control process. And there was a year or two ago where it dipped to the 70s. I think it was 74% in 1 year, but it's gone back to 87%. I think there's a slide in the presentation that points to that. If you look at that slide on there. So that's the part of the quality control. But on the other side, Chair, the point you are making where you were saying that we all live in our constituencies, and I guess it's coming from the fact that there are certain things that you see as people who experience daily what happens, and you perhaps try to relate that thing that you experience to what an audit conclusion says in certain instances. And there will always be gaps in that area, I think, because there's always an expectation gap between auditors in terms of where and how and what the scope of the work they do. And if you try and compare that with many varied people's experiences with or without assumptions, it may be difficult to come to whether your observations can translate to a conclusion that the conclusion of the audit was probably lacking in quality. I think it's a matter that we think that over time we will learn to understand exactly where the gap is. But the issue of the sourcing and the recruitment and the retention of people, we do that, if I got your question, very purposely, in that we retain people, Chair, that are willing to remain around in the office, but we also use our own discretion to assess their competencies and capacity over the years to be able to dish out correct conclusions on our audits. So I think there are many elements of that, but of course the other part which supports our quality is the need for us to continue to insist on supervision by those that are experienced auditors. There's often a cry that the people that are sent out to do audits are young and all of that. Well, we were young as well, even younger than these ones who are here when we were also starting out in our apprenticeship as auditors. But I think the value that comes out of an audit is if there are sufficient numbers of people in the supervisory chain, that issue becomes less of an issue because the final evaluation and conclusion of evidence that's gathered in an audit is like that of an articled clerk in a law firm who's not the one who writes the final report about the findings of a particular case, but is the one who must know where are the principal documents that need to be read by the principal partner before a conclusion is made. So there are many internal checks that are here, but on top of this, Chair, also we very closely adhere to the International Standard on Quality Control, ISQC-1. It's a standard that lays out the basic things that need to be in place in an audit institution for it to have a better chance of producing credible results. And our firm-level review that was done by IRBA not long ago confirmed that a lot of these issues, including quality control, including supervision, including regular training of staff, are things that are in place which we observe as an office. So that's the part. And then the outsourcing, Honorable Man, regarding the cost side of it. If you look at the basket of work that we do, it's almost indiscriminate in that we must do all of the national, all of the provincial, and all of the local government. Now, the provincial and the national have only got 1 year end, and that is March, as well as the municipalities have got a June year end. So what we often do, and this research was done some years ago, and we haven't updated it, but in the earlier years, let's say about 7-10 years ago, the office did an exercise to say there will never be a day, and this is something that is determined upfront, there will never be a day where the office would need to have all of the people doing the work for it under its roof as its employees. Because the risk is that you might go out and recruit and double up the staff size, but the level of productivity of those people is going to be much lower over time because you've only got two peak periods to which to respond. Then we did an analysis and said, based on past experience, to the extent of about 20 to 25% of our audit responsibilities are largely going to be done outside by private audit firms, where we allocate a predetermined total percentage of our work to the different firms. Because we know that those firms, I'm coming to the cost issue now, those firms, all they need to do is to send that team of people to go do that work in that institution, come back and report. They don't carry any overhead for those people. It is just a direct cost that they pick up. Versus us, if we were to do it ourselves, not only would we be paying those people the salaries, which are typically the same thing as we are paying the outsourced firms, but on top of it, we've also got to make sure we've got the necessary physical facilities to accommodate them and other overhead costs that come with having to have a permanent employee. So let's say the person that we employ on a full-time basis, as an assumption that we are not going to outsource, costs the office, let's say, R1 million. And the person's recoverability, because of the peak period that is busy but other periods are not busy, this person is probably productive to the extent on an annual basis of about, let's say, 600,000. Just the one scenario. R1 million is what it costs to have you as our employee, together with all the costs associated with you being an employee, R1 million. But when we send you out to do the audits in that one financial year, the value received based on the charge out rate that we use and the hours spent comes to about 600,000. So you're already kind of in a loss situation. Now take that scenario and take the firm that comes with the staff that are going to do that work. Maybe the outsourced work is about 800,000, and that's all we pay, 800,000, no more. Because those people live in PwC or Deloitte or ENY or Sizwe Ntsaluba, so their costs are made up and recovered in their home base. Here, all we say is that it is cheaper for us to do it that way, because we just get you for 6 weeks to do this exercise and you go. We don't have to worry about your costs for the other 11 months. So that's the logic. So we then say it will make it cheaper for government to do this work in accordance with this process, to make sure that we recruit sufficient people to do it ourselves, but make sure that we do it at a cheaper level of cost when we outsource it to private audit firms. Otherwise, the cost of doing it would probably have been more than double what we are showing up in the books, because there are people who will be sitting idle around, but you must worry for their medical aid, you must worry for their accommodation, you must worry for laptops, you must worry for all sorts of other things. So that is the determining factor that we use. So one can then say that it has proven over time that the cost of outsourcing is probably cheaper than having to do it internally for everything. Now, Chair, KPMG. We still have 7 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. Chair, you will recall that there was a report that was issued by KPMG International, their international firm, pointing all sorts of things that had gone wrong and were found in the investigation that was done on the South African KPMG. Once we saw that, we then went and requested an interaction with the leadership of that organization and said to them, we also need to respond as an audit office to the revelations that have come out from the investigation report. Therefore, we would like to have an interaction with yourselves. We met them and we asked them two questions, Chair. And these questions we believe that were important for us as an audit office without dismissing what we read in the investigation report. But we wanted to know, is this report telling us now that those considerations of independence and professional capacity, which is the two key tests that we use in determining who does work on our behalf, we ask the question, are you now telling us that these particular assumptions of independence and professional competence, are they still intact or not, based on what we see in this report? Because if you remember, that report was about two key transactions, one on the SARS matter and the other one on the audit work they did for the Gupta Link company. Therefore, we didn't want to make a conclusion based on the fact that their own firm made findings on them on these two matters. We wanted to check whether these are now indicative of a systemic breakdown in the areas that will ensure that we are still comfortable with your practice management and risk management disciplines. That answer, for it to be a credible answer, can only come from the independent investigation that is being done, because that independent investigation, one by IRBA, SAICA, as well as by them, I think, will give us a more comprehensive answer to say that here there has been a significant breakdown, or that particular matter which was identified in that report was not typical of what this particular firm has now become. So that question has not yet been answered for us. But what we said then was, instead of allocating this work for over a two-year period like we have been doing with other audit firms, because all of the firms that we allocate contract work, we do it over a two-month cycle, or rather two-year cycle. We then said, because of this issue, we are going to then shorten the period on which yours has been allocated as KPMG because of these matters to 1 year, so that it can give us a quick turnaround to deal with whatever issues might arise in the 1 year that we have allocated. And we are still waiting, obviously, for the outcome of those investigations to then know whether the decision that we have taken to reduce the work to 1 year still stands or something else happens. And that's where, Chair, we came from this. And I think we were informed by the fact that, and I said this when I went to Scopa the other day, Chair, that if you look at the auditing profession in general, maybe we as a South African audit office are possibly insulated from those risks because we just audit. We have no business development objective in that you must build relationships and capacity to sell more work kind of stuff. Ours is already sold to us through the Constitution. So we don't have to do too many things that might encroach in our ability to remain objective in evaluating certain things. So I think there's a different issue that needs to be looked at here, which is not just a KPMG unique matter. And that's why it is important for the profession to look deeper into all of these matters, because we've been on this path before. And I made reference when we spoke at SCOPA that the Master Bond Group of Companies, HCNL Commission report, which was released first in 1997 and then finally in 2001, revealed a lot of these matters that are popping up again. Perhaps now they are coming up in one environment because of whatever reasons, but typically there have been issues of this nature that sometimes knock holes into conclusions that are made by auditors. They were identified before, nothing was ever done around them. So our view has been that while we are taking this particular stance as far as the KPMG audit is concerned, so when we said we are continuing with them, we meant and we still mean that we are not going to take away the audits, but we are going to put them on terms that will ensure that they are responsive to the issues that are part of this investigation. Now, the reality is that the 2015-2016 audit, which is what the last engagement we had with them was about, has already been signed off even prior to that investigation report coming out. The next cycle of audits that we are going to do with them will be the year ending March 2018. That's the next set of audits that they may get something to do with. We are hoping that the final outcome of those independent investigations will probably already have come out by the time they have to get involved in doing this audit. So even though we've taken this decision, we are still on safe ground. It's not like every month we issue work. The work that they were issued last, they have already signed off on. They are waiting for the next round of financial year's work now. So I hope then, by then, I don't think those investigations will take a very, very long time before we can make our call on it. So that is effectively the conclusion, Chair. So in essence, it is about saying we took what we considered to be the reasonable steps in reducing the amount of work allocated, but allowing the overall profession to reflect on what are they seeing beyond just those two audits that were referred to in that other report. Thanks.
All right. Any more from this side of the table? If not, any more from that side of the table? If not, Honorable Kuno.
Thank you, Chairperson. I hope you did take my apology earlier. And thanks for the presentation. I have a follow-up in what Honorable Mente asked earlier on. And on the job that the AG will outsource to other auditors to do the job, and I agree. I understand what where he comes from in terms of, you know, the million rands as opposed to the value for money that you'll be bringing, because you'll need... You'll only need that for a period of 2 months. But AG, our experience from SCOPA is that when you look at the audit outcomes from these private firms, from one department to the other, they are worse off. And to me, and this is the conclusion of some of us that we've made as SCOPA members, that they actually tell them what they want to hear because they want to be reappointed, which becomes a serious problem. And if you're saying we are serious of trying to make sure that your outcomes or your powers are actually, you have more powers to actually do what we have given you to do today, and we are going to use private firms, I don't think we are going to solve the problems that you want to solve. It's just a comment, and maybe the AG can think about it and the DAG, because it's a problem, really, if you look at audit outcomes, if you look at that particular department per se and, you know, the jobs that they've been given to private firms. I know that there are others who hire their own auditors before the AG can actually outsource or do anything. I know there's a difference about that as well, but I'm just saying that they should look into that as well. Thanks, Chair.
All right. Now, you don't have to, if you want to respond, you can respond, but I do think that it's a debate that we must continue to have.
the pros and cons of total audit by the Supreme Audit Institution versus the dishing out some of the work. I mean, there will be pros and cons from both sides of it, but I think it must be a debate that we must continue to have. Think about it, DAG. That day when we come, we will set aside about 10 minutes or so that this passion that Honorable Mente and Kuno and some of us have, let's put it on the table and have that discussion. We've heard initially what the motivation is, but I do think that we should just, it's not going to ever be a real answer, but at least we have an understanding of why the AG does certain things. And AG must understand why we have concerns about what you do about certain things. There might not be an answer, but members feel that they're only happy when you sign it off, and if it's not signed off by somebody else, at least hear them. You can disagree with them, but hear them. And then the same from our side. If we think that AG must do it for whatever reason, then at least let's hear them. But we'll continue the debate. Thank you very much. We will come back to you, DAG, as soon as we've managed to look at our program and give you a whole day just to go, not a whole day, but the normal 3 hours to go through what we should have gone through today and give you 2 or 3 days. Possible dates that will suit you and suit the rest of the committee, and we'll have that engagement. But like I say, the worst case scenario ideal would be the 17th of, the outer date would be the 17th of November, but we're hoping to do that before then. Having said that, AG and your team, thank you very much, not just for this session, but also for the previous session. We might come back to you with one or two things. I think on the 17th, we would not say that you are not welcome, even if you just come and sit as a spy on the wall, because it impacts you. So we might not give you a formal invite on the 17th of November. No, I'm talking to the people that are the lawmakers. I'm saying besides, remember the 17th what we are doing. We are finalizing from our side the act. And there's nothing wrong with you sitting there and getting a sense of what the mood is. So you're not going to influence us, but you'll get a mood. So you're more than welcome to come. But DAG, if we don't do anything else, you'll come on the 17th. If we have it before the 17th, we'll have it with you, which means it's a closed meeting, so to say, on the 17th. But we're opening it up to you to come in. When I say you, I'm saying the audit team, to come and join us. Because the 17th we put aside for finalizing our Public Audit Act. Thank you very much to our friends in the media, to our colleagues from support from the committee section. Thank you very much, AG and your team. Thank you very much. We'll see each other next on the 17th of November in terms of SCOAC. But the other committees, political party funding next week, Koli, oversight next week as well. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.